This podcast was originally live streamed on the Non Sequitur Show on YouTube. New episodes air weekdays, Monday through Friday, at 8 p.m. Eastern at youtube.com/nonsequiturshow. Make sure you never miss a live stream by visiting www.nonsecshow.com/schedule. For the latest news, polls and updates throughout the day, follow us on Twitter at nonsecshow or facebook.com/nonsecshow. That's NONSEQ show. If you'd like to get exclusive content, bi-weekly private hangouts with Kyle and Steve, backstage access to chat with guests after shows hosted on your channel and much more, become a Patreon saint of Non Sequitur. It ensures we continue to improve our show and brings you into the process at the same time. Visit patreon.com/nonsequitur today while the limited spots are still available.
The following podcast is intended for those who believe bold ideas are righteous, unique perspectives are gospel, and strong opinions are sacred. This is Non Sequitur. Never follow. And now, here are your hosts, Kyle Curtis and Steve McRae.
Welcome to That's BS. I'm Jordan.
I'm Adam.
And today we are graced by the presence of Kyle from the Non Sequitur Show.
Graced. What an accurate way to say it.
Yes, I thought I'd bring in the religious tones. Kyle, how are you? And why don't you open up by telling us, telling the audience about your show and where they can find you and everything like that.
Sure. I'm Kyle Curtis. I am the host and creator of the Non Sequitur Show, which is a show that features debates, discussions, and dumpster fires. If you haven't been familiar with our show, I encourage you to continue not to be, because it should be under a medical advisement. Sometimes it raises people's blood pressure and just can cause you to hallucinate, which is true. It's just true. I sat last night watching the show that we had going on. It went for 3 hours, and it was just so bizarre that I questioned like where I was in reality. So yeah, if you don't know about it yet, you're lucky and stay that way. But yeah.
Yeah. The most recent episode that I listened to of yours was, a few back, it was about whether or not it was kind of ethical to bring on people that you disagreed with and platform them.
Oh, yes.
That was a good episode. There was a lot of dissent in the people who joined you on that one.
There's a lot of dissent. And it's been quite the controversy. It sparked a larger discussion, which I think is necessary. But the interesting thing is the way that I sort of became – more, I guess, sought after in terms of the attacks or whatever, than the person that they were protesting against me having on. It was an interesting dynamic. I slowly became worse than that guy. I'm just a person that believes that, you know, there are ideas and there are people who have ideas that make you uncomfortable. And there's two ways you can address that. You can ignore those ideas and they won't go away if you do. Or you can try to battle those bad ideas with good ideas and hope that there is someone out there who has been, you know, under the guise of this bad idea that sees the point that you're trying to make. And in that way, you can sort of invoke a change. But ignoring it doesn't do anything to solve the problem. Now, there's nothing wrong with either of those options. There's nothing wrong with ignoring it, and there's nothing wrong to me with having that discussion. But I'm not afraid to have that discussion. And some people... For some people, that's just, you know, they can't handle that.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. We've sort of talked about that a little bit on our show, mm-hmm. both on and off air. And I think the kind of group consensus we've come to is, if you're going to have someone on whose ideas you think are legitimately dangerous, then it's sort of your responsibility to push back on them in real time. And that's sort mm-hmm. of like a personal stance that we have. But that's sort of where we've settled on it.
Absolutely. I think that's a, like, you have to be able to See, the misconception is that people started painting things as that, you know, me and I'm just going to give an example. It's, mm-hmm. it's like, you know, you shouldn't platform Nazis. And when you do platform them and you go after those ideas, which is what we did, he wasn't an actual Nazi, but I'm just using this as an example. They then say, act like you just had on a Nazi and we're chumming it up. You know,
yeah,
like,
had a cup of tea with a Nazi.
Yeah, tell me about the Third Reich. What's going on in the Third Reich this year? You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't that way. It was somebody actively in defiance of their ideas. And so to me, that pretty distinctly says, I don't agree with this guy. I'm trying to show him where he's wrong. And to me, there's never harm in that. Never harm in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess someone's line, maybe Sam Harris is or something, that, or maybe Douglas Murray is actually, that good ideas will tend to beat bad ones if they're brought into fresh light because good ideas just have more to stand on.
Sure.
Some line like that. I can't remember who said that. But yeah, so we wanted to kind of open up the religious talk, though, with a discussion of your background, because it sounds like it might have been similar in a lot of ways to Adam and mine.
Sure. Steve said he'll be in just a few.
Oh, great. Yeah.
So Steve will join us. Yes, I grew up as a young Earth creationist until I was about 25. I grew up Southern Baptist. And for the first part, then we became independent Baptist. And if you don't know what an independent Baptist is, that's the answer to the question, what is more far right to a Southern Baptist? So if Southern Baptists aren't conservative enough for you, then you want to go independent.
Okay, great. Yeah, sign me up.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. And so I grew up as a young Earth creationist. Also, little caveat, I am also a gay man. Hmm. So
here we'll have to ask you to leave the show then. No.
Oh yeah. Okay. I can do it. But yeah, no, it's you grow up listening to how you are an abomination, or, you know, you are less than because of just you're attracted to you know, somebody of the same sex. And I hate to tell everybody this, but it is not a choice, because if it was, I would have chosen at that time to not be gay. It just wasn't working. And eventually, I was at a youth night one night. We were leaving, and one of my friends was watching an R&Ra video. He was on the Atheist Experience, actually, and he was laughing. And I was like, what's so funny? And he's like, this guy saying that there's slavery in the Bible. And I remember going, well, how can he lie like that? There's no slavery in the Bible. And I went home and pulled up that R&Ra episode and was watching it. Went to the Bible verse he was throwing out there, and son of a bitch, there was slavery in the Bible. Yeah. And, you know, you don't, but it makes sense. You don't hear about this stuff on Sunday, you know, in the mm-hmm. pulpit. They're not going to get up there and preach about how, so that video led me to watching more R&Ra videos. And the more I watched, and the more I went and verified these things in the Bible, the more I was just totally appalled. And it just didn't make sense that if there was a God, he definitely isn't Christian. Definitely is not the Christian God. And so I had to come out of a second closet, the atheist closet.
Huh. That's a really interesting backstory. So was it, I'm curious, was it the sort of abhorrent moral things that you found in the Bible that was the main thing that drove you away, or was it something else?
It was the complete, I felt lied to about, it's almost like this. Let's say you were dating someone, right? You meet somebody online, you go out for a bunch of dates, and they're just the most wonderful person. They talk about all of these, like, these charity things that they do, how much they love their family. Everything's just amazing. And so for a couple years, you guys are dating, and it couldn't be any better. All you see is the them doing charitable work, blah, 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 blah. Well, then you move in together, and that person starts hitting you out of nowhere, just hitting you and then telling you how much he loves you. That's how I felt, because For the longest time, I'd been getting this one side of the Bible, this, oh, God loves us. God doesn't want any harm to become of us. Because that's what you're fed. That's what you're spoon fed in church. But the moment that, I watched that Arn video, I saw the dark side of the Bible. And no matter how wonderful that significant other has been to you those 2 years, the moment that they strike you, all of that's null and void because you see this dark side, and spending eternity with that person that is just so quick to beat you while telling you that they love you, I just couldn't be okay with.
Huh. So what, I'm curious, what kept you in kind of the grasps of religion until 25? Because Adam and I, it sounds like we had a pretty similar upbringing, evangelical and Baptist upbringing, but both of us kind of really seriously began to doubt around the age of, somewhere between 14, 15, 16. Adam, mm-hmm. does that sound right to you?
Yeah, it sounds pretty right. I mean, I think we were, pretty, we were looking through the Bible, finding ridiculous passages probably at the age of 14.
Yeah.
How could this be written by, an omniscient being, when it's just the most ridiculous passages, but I probably at the age of 14.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So, I'm curious, what kept you in religion for so long?
Up until I saw that video, I genuinely believed it. My family was such that they were all super, super religious, still are. And I thought with the gay thing, I thought that was me. I thought that was something that I needed to work on. So much so that I actually dated somebody for 3 years, a girl, and we were engaged. I was so close to getting married. And I would lay in bed at night begging for, God to not make me feel that way anymore. I didn't want to be gay anymore. And so I literally tried everything because I thought it was a me issue. But when I saw this other side, when I saw these other these contradictions, this evilness, and this just how really religion has been used over the past several thousand years to control people, to discriminate against people, to impose a will on people, the floodgates opened, and it all just kind of hit me at once. But up until that point, I genuinely thought that this was how it was. That God was obviously real, and only people who just want to sin and who have no moral compass, that was the way it was.
Wow. So it sounds like it was a pretty immediate kind of switch for you, or
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It was, it took about a week. I binge watched those videos for about a week. And, like I said, I was checking verses and stuff as he was going along. And, I, at the end of it, could not honestly say that two things. I couldn't honestly say that the God was real anymore because of what this book said and the apparent contradictions. And number two, even if he was, knowing this other side, I could not be okay with worshiping a deity for eternity that was okay doing that sort of thing. And ultimately, here's what it came down to me. This was the final thing that put the nail in the coffin. In the Garden of Eden, right, you have a tree that caused all of the world's suffering because she ate the fruit, right? Mm-hmm. The earth, I'm assuming, the earth didn't change, right? The earth's the same size now as it was back then. So of all of the geographical locations that God could have placed that tree, knowing what would happen, he puts it in the garden with the only two people on the entire planet.
Yeah,
the only two. He puts it there.
The middle of the garden. Too.
Right. Yeah. Why not put it on the other side of the planet where they could never get to it? And and the other thing is, you made that tree with the power to do that. And when it happened, why not just say, oh, you ate of the tree? Well, I told you not to. I'm disappointed. But I don't feel like going through 3,000 years of just famine, disease, murder, rapes, abuse, all of this turmoil. I don't feel like creating a bodily version of myself and then sacrificing myself on a cross to myself to pay for this. So why don't we just say it's don't do it again. I'm going to uproot the tree. I'm going to move it to, where the United States is. You don't need to know about that. Yeah. And we'll call it even. But he didn't do that.
Hmm. Yeah, the absurdity of it all, he was definitely one of the first movers for me and Adam. I know that. I mean, I just like thinking about one of the things for me was just thinking about like the kind of redundancy of human beings in the first place, because it was like, you know, God made these perfect beings, the angels, to worship him day and night, but then for some reason he kind of grew tired of his own creation and then dabbled in the playground of the earth to make these far less perfect beings, and who, you know, could defy him, could not, and he chooses to kind of meddle in their affairs or not, and it just mm-hmm. it seems so absurd to me and so unnecessary.
Speaking of what was the word you used? Lesser beings.
Yeah.
Steve, absurd. Steve, welcome. I think you're searching for absurd.
Absurd.
Welcome, yeah.
It's, oh, also welcome, Steve. Yeah. Sorry.
Hey, nice to be here. Yeah. I'm an absurd lesser being. My transition story is not as eloquent as Kyle's. I didn't have that moment of epiphany where I said, you know, I no longer believe. It was over several years, and I just kind of fell away. So I don't really have that much of a transition story. Although I, you know, there was a few things, though, when Kyle talks about things that he didn't see in the Bible as a believer, right? I can kind of emphasize with that a little bit. When we did Bible studies, there seemed to be a lot of stuff they missed for some reason, mm-hmm. but they didn't really go over very much. Mm-hmm. And I did go to Sunday school. I used to go to Sunday school before class in high school. I went to a Mormon church. But there was one story, though, that does stand out. It was Jephthah from the Book of Judges, where he was a general, and he was led the Israelites against the Ammonites. And he made a vow to God saying that he would kill the first thing that walks through the door if he would win the battles and stuff like that. And the first thing when he got home from the battles happened to be his daughter. And I had never heard this story before. This was actually, I mean, literally sometime last year. Never heard this story before. I was like, that's not in the Bible.
And what did he do, Steve? What did he do?
Well, supposedly he killed her, but some say that he didn't. But even either way, I'm thinking to myself still, though, I'm like, that doesn't sound like a God to me. What is that? How does that work? That I'm going to make a pact with God that for some reason I'm just going to arbitrarily say I'm going to kill the first thing that comes out of my door when I get home.
Yeah. Why would God? Why would God make that agreement though? You know,
I don't know.
Supposedly, murder's on the top 10 list of things that you shouldn't do to other people. So why would God say, "Oh, you want to kill the first thing that walks in the door? Sure, I'll let you win the battle for that."
Yeah. It doesn't make
any sense. That's insane. That's insanity.
And ultimately, that's just one of you know, many infinite stories in the Bible that just need constant explanation, right?
Sure.
I mean, like the Jephthah story, you were saying that, you know, there are some apologists that come out and say, no, you know, they really sent her away, you know, to live, you know, a life of chastity.
Right.
But in reality, if you read the story, you know, he makes the vow, and ultimately it says he did as he vowed, right?
Yeah.
So did he kill her or not? And so you have, you know, an army of apologists to just make excuses for every one of these stories. And if you step back, you begin to realize, wait a second, how come there are excuses all throughout the Bible? Maybe it is just as it seems. You know, maybe it's as ridiculous as it seems. So
it is. I can tell you it is. It is absolutely ridiculous as it seems.
It wasn't like he had a stable home front either. I mean, his mother was a prostitute and he was a general, you know. And so, I mean, it wasn't like he came from like nobility or something like that.
It's just the thing it boils down to is if I'm God, right, and I created everybody here, I want and I truly want them to spend eternity with me. Like that's a legitimate thing. I truly want them to spend eternity. I don't want to see them burn for eternity in hell. Why do I not create a book that is crystal clear, that doesn't result in thousands of denominations, other religions, like a book that says step number one, X, step number two, X, step number three, X. And if you don't follow these steps, then you will go to hell. By the way, a place I also created, place that since I'm God, I could turn off at any time. He could dial back that thermostat in hell anytime he wanted to. And if he can't, then he's not all powerful. So how can you continue to believe with those questions? I don't see how it's possible.
Wouldn't you rather, enjoy reading stories about, you know, a man named Lot offering his virgin daughters to a mob I mean, isn't that just isn't that just more compelling at the end of the day? I mean,
absolutely.
Why have some sort of, you know, step by step guide when you can read about these, you know, ignorant, monstrous characters? I
mean, it's just your eternity. It's not a big deal.
But yeah. If
all of it's true, though, let's say all of it is 100% true. Okay, is that really a guy that you want to spend forever bowing to and praising?
Well, don't forget in Genesis, Lot's daughters, both of them supposedly got him drunk and took advantage of him one night to get impregnated.
Oh, great. No, I'd much rather hear about the incest. That's better than
a classic pastime.
Yeah.
Because that happens all the time, right? I mean, that's just a frequent occurrence.
Yeah, I can't wait to become a father. It's going to be wonderful.
And it's honestly that continuous trope throughout the Bible of just evil women that are just, you know, attempting to seduce and destroy men, right? I mean, you see, like, I mean, apparently Lot was the only pure man, you know. I forget if he was in, you know, either Sodom and Gomorrah. I forget which town exactly, but, you know, but he was the only pure man. So, of course, his daughters raped this old man. Like, you know, are you serious? Like, oh, yeah, that's probably what happened.
They paint sex as such a bad thing, but if it's really so bad, why did God make it feel so good?
to tempt you, of course.
Like, seriously. So, okay, good. I'm glad that you said that answer, because that means who is the biggest trickster in this story?
Hmm. Yeah, at least Satan's straightforward. He tells you what he's doing.
Yeah. Right.
Well, you know, there are some narratives that Satan, the Satan, you know, isn't some evil being. It's just the basically like a prosecuting attorney, and that he's actually the most truthful one because he's telling it the way it is. This is some narrative, you know, that some Satanist type use too. But he doesn't lie, and that's like the greatest way to deceive is to sometimes tell the truth.
His character pretty much became more solidified in Revelation, right? Because like, I mean, in the Old Testament, he acts, you know, as the tempter with, you know, Job, and and even in the New Testament with Jesus. But in at the end of the New Testament, his character is really solidified as this demon-like character, and that's the only one they seem to see him as. So,
is it rational to think that because you were made fun of for having a bald head, and you asked God to help you out with that, You went like a crybaby to God and said, "These kids were making fun of me for having a bald head." Is it rational that God would then say, "You're right, that should never happen," and send a herd of bears to tear these people apart just for making fun of your bald head? Is that somebody that you want to praise for eternity? No.
My favorite apologetic for that is, quote, "They weren't kids, they were teens." Like, that makes it any better.
Oh, yeah, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I've seen those videos too where they're like, you know, there were some unruly teens that seemed to be, you know, verbally accosting him. And I'm like, okay, where are you getting this from the passage? Like, are you, it seems like you're adding this and you're just ashamed of the story.
Do you know what I'm saying? The Catholic Church will says that Bill Donahue, the director of the Catholic League, said that very same thing, Steve, did he not, about these sexual assaults? He said, well, they're talking like it's child rape. These kids were adolescent.
Yep.
Like, that's
that's appalling.
Yep. Yes.
He was trying to negate the whole thing of, it wasn't really child molestation. It was more adolescent molestation.
Like, that makes it okay. Yeah.
I've heard a similar argument on the Atheist Experience, and they were kind of diving down the inevitable rabbit hole that if God is omnipresent, he is there watching children being raped. He is there in the moment watching and observing children being raped. And the caller kind of responded, was like, "Well, you act as that little kid's innocent." And they're like,
"Oh, I remember that now."
Like, are you serious? Like that's your best response?
I've heard that apologetic before, but here's the here's a contradiction that I find, though. If God is everywhere, right, omniscient and all knowing, and it happens to be omnipresent everywhere, but how at the same time he's out of time? Because
what do you mean by that?
Well, a lot of narrative, for example, there's a position called theistic personalism, which is similar to classical theism, is where God acts as this great demiurge of the universe, that he basically sustains the universe from some outside perspective, kind of looking in, right? Instead of being one with the universe where he's pervasive everywhere, he's kind of outside space-time looking in. So he could, time is not a concept to him, right?
Okay. Which
I'm not quite sure how that works, but let's go with it. But at the same time, he's omnipresent in the universe, but at the same time, he's outside time. That actually is a contradiction.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's another kind of variant of that objection, which is like, how could there be, you know, because the we're sort of talking about like how could God punish us for things that like he set up for us to do? And a lot of objections will be like, well, God gave us free will. So it's a choice whether or not we, you know, we choose to follow him. But what I've never understood about that is that if God is omnipotent, so he can do anything, and he's omniscient, so he's everywhere, and he exists across all times, like he's seen what's going to happen already, well, then he by definition, by your own definitions that you've given him, he has the power to create any circumstances over the duration of your entire life that he wants.
Absolutely.
So he created the circumstances of your birth, the course of your life, and your death. So he knows already before you're created what you'll do. So I don't know how free will can blossom out of that.
Think about another thing, though. Is it really free will if he's allowing you to have it? Like,
sort of, yes.
It is
free will. That's free will is be able to decide without undue influence. But we don't have limited free will. But here's the funniest thing is that apologetics will run something called Molinism. S.J. Thompson is very famous for running Molinism. Although she, no offense to S.J., I love her to death, she doesn't understand Molinism. She throws it out there as like a defense of something, right? Well, because Molinism. Well, what's Molinism? Oh, I don't know, but it sounds good. But basically, it's an intermediate position that William Lane Craig argues that God, he knows everything, but he limits himself such that what he does is he says this: okay, I know what Kyle's going to do given two situations. If he's put in situation X, he's going to do A. If he's put in Y, he's going to do B. I want B to manifest. So what he does, God creates a modal possible world that actualizes, that puts Kyle in the B, Y, not A, so he does B. So Kyle still has a choice.
That's so dumb.
It doesn't resolve everything, trust me.
Where did they get that from, though? Like where in the book does that come from? There
nowhere.
Are so many people
nowhere.
Reaching for answers to this stuff that has no basis in the literature. They go with it because it sounds good. Well, okay, that's a possibility. So let's go with it. And people buy it hook, line, and sinker because for some reason it's in us that there has to be something to this. Like this, none of this could happen by a chain of unplanned events that led to where we are today. This has to be something that is put in motion by a grand architect. And it's just, you have to divorce yourself from that and look at what the book actually says. If you're going to profess to follow the book, read it, all of it. And if you read the Bible from cover to cover, 9 times out of 10, I will bet you will be an atheist by the time it's over. If you can come out and be a Christian, then you're just, you're turning a blind eye to a lot of things in that book.
Well, that was, I mean, one thing that Adam and I explored incessantly when we were just kind of leaving the church was the fact that, I mean, it has to be less than 10% of the Bible is ever discussed in a church sermon.
Right.
Where it's just, it is sort of weird that, like, you'll notice that, like, they'll kind of do a, at least in my church, we used to do these sort of projects of several sermons that were like a series of a book, but it would be always a very short book in the New Testament. And I always kind of wondered, why don't we ever do that with like Deuteronomy or Leviticus or even other books in the New Testament? Like what's that one book one verse in 2 Timothy? A man cannot be taught anything by a woman, something like that. It's just like a piece of pristine wisdom from God or something like that.
Here's what you have to like. This is what I take away from it. If you read something in the book where it's like for me in my story, it was the slavery issue. If you read that and then you go to someone in the church and you tell them like, or ask them like, how can this be? How can God seemingly be okay with slavery? The answer that you'll usually get is that something like this: oh, it's not the same kind of slavery. Oh, it's indentured servitude. Or you'll get this, and this is what's really scary. You'll get the it was God's decision. God made us. He has the right to do that. When you get in your mind that you can in some way explain away owning a person and being able to beat them within an inch of their life as long as they don't die within 3 days, my brain can't do that. My brain could not get past that. Even if it is God, even if he is real and those things happen, I could not be okay with worshiping a deity that is okay with that. So it takes a lot to be able to sort of, condition your mind to explain away not even your own actions, someone else's actions, and try to be okay with it. To tell yourself that, okay, I can get past this because it's God. Mm. I think that takes a lot.
I think it becomes very easy to do that because I'm under the impression that most people actually don't believe in the God of the Bible. They believe in the God of the 21st century, which has been a sort of modified and distilled God that is all loving,
sure,
all wise, all powerful. You know, just this, this sphere of perfection, right? But sure. but that actually isn't the God of the Bible. So, like you were just saying, so if you go into the Bible and you begin to sort of juxtapose this God you've been fed with the God that is found in the Bible, you can very easily, I would say, if you've drank the Kool-Aid, you can easily rationalize and say, well, ultimately the God I believe in wouldn't do the things, portrayed in the Bible. Or if, that being did, then I'm sure there was, some wiser and more benevolent reason given the God that I believe in, right? But it's not the God of the Bible. You know what I mean? Like, do you understand where I'm coming from there?
Yeah. Don't drink the Kool-Aid, though. Yeah. I know that tagline from somewhere. Yeah.
That's very well said, I think.
Can I give another Bible verse that you had never heard in Sunday school? Because I never did. It was news to me. And by the way, is this a PG podcast or can I go a little?
No, this is R-rated.
Okay, good. Oh, you have Kyle here, of course. Okay. Okay, we're going to go full triple. Ezekiel 23:20-21.
Oh, I love this one.
King James Version. For she doted upon her paramours, whose flesh is the flesh of asses, and whose issue is like the issue of horses. Paramours is lovers, and dotted means to bestow a great amount of affection or love for excessive amount. Now, what's funny is if you actually go to the ERV, which is the easy-to-read version of the Bible, it's a little more explicit. This is how it translates. I don't know if you've ever seen the ERV version, but it translates this. She remembered her lover with the penis of a donkey and the flood of semen like a horse.
As all good lovers.
Wow. Easiest read for kids, right? That's the easy to read version for the kids to say, oh, I don't understand the passage in the Bible. Oh, it's because it's talking about a penis of a donkey and the flood of a semen like a horse.
Wait a minute. I didn't know this. I didn't even
Wait, really? Oh, this is
real?
It's a classic. Yes, this is Ezekiel 23:20.
What the fuck?
It's my favorite Bible verse.
I didn't know either. This was news. Well, I mean, I don't. It was like last year I found that out. So it was. I never knew growing up, though. Hell no.
Well, I mean, hey, guy that she's dreaming about. That's
impressive. Good job to her, right?
I mean, can't you just sort of, hear the divinity just flow from those words right there. I mean, just true omniscience. I mean, it's not something I could have come up with. Certainly not. I mean,
to that point though, can you imagine these books were inspired by God, right? God spoke to these people and told, the people writing them to it. Can you imagine the look on the guy's face when he's like, what was that last part? No,
I didn't quite get that. The King James Version is so fiery. We had somebody on our show. It was a doctor, Josh Bowen. And the language that they use is so flowery, right? And he goes into detail of the King James Version. And who else went into that? There was somebody else who went into the same thing. Jerry Griffith went into it as well. Well, I think they both have kind of delved into it. But But yeah, it's like the Kingdom Age version makes it sound so great, right? So, wow, she doteth her paramours. Oh, that's flowery.
It's horseshit. Everybody, it's
horseshit. It's horse cum, actually.
I think you got the wrong slide. It comes out the front.
The book is horseshit.
I've actually seen a general trend with sort of taming the Bible in that sense. It's kind of a dangerous one. I hear myself echoing. Am I?
Yeah. Check if your headphones are correctly plugged in, Adam. You might be doing like audio through your laptop speakers.
How's that?
Is that better? Oh, yeah, it's better. That's better.
All right, so so what I was saying was like what I've seen is sort of a general dangerous trend with newer Bibles that have been created and translated. I'm echoing again, shit.
Yeah,
is that for me?
It just started. Adam when it happens.
All right, let's try that. We'll try that again.
That's okay, Adam.
My bad.
Performance anxiety happens to us all.
This happens for yourself. On our show every night.
Well, Adam's fixing that. I wanted to backtrack for a second and get you two to respond on so about the I can hear myself now. The slavery in the Bible. One sort of like I've heard a defense of that where God revealed these kind of moral truths in stages of progressions, right? Where it was too radical to introduce full full stop, no slavery in general. So he eased the Israelites into it, where he started with, you may not keep males as slaves for more than 7 years, but women you can keep indefinitely. Then women were granted the 7-year status as men. Then both were eventually required to be freed. Boy. Then it was no Israelites, but other people. Then it was only other people of like a certain, you know, race or whatever. And so it was this sort of progressive, I'm doing air quotes for our audio listeners, progressive, you know, iterative thing of morality. I've never bought that for a second.
Bullshit. Here's why.
Yeah.
He is he in several verses instructs people that they can't wear garments that are made of different materials. He tells them they shouldn't eat shrimp. He lays out 10 commandments where they are they're all about the top 3 are about worshiping other gods. They're don't covet your neighbors. Like, he lays out all of these detailed, specific rules. Mm-hmm. And the most important one, like above shrimp and above mixed clothes, he couldn't say don't own people, don't treat other people as property. That's insane to put that in as an excuse. That's absolutely insane.
I was reading a paper just yesterday, matter of fact, and I brought it to Dr. Alex Malpass' attention. I was having a conversation with him. He's a well-known philosopher in our group, and we were talking about what was called the moral epistemological argument for atheism. Hmm. And I'm going to do the details of the argument per se, but it basically the counter apologist, because he had asked me, Alex had asked me, how would you counter this, you know, if an apologist says something along these lines, because he likes to challenge me, because he, you know, he's an ass like that. but I love Alex. He's a great guy. And the thing was that the apologist would say something along the lines of God was trying to bestow a higher epistemic standard to people by explaining to them morality incrementally, or in more specifically that just stop, because in order to know good, we have to know evil. So in order, we have to know immorality to know morality. Mm-hmm. And so God would allow for this immoral type things. God would allow for these so-called sins or transgressions, because it was teaching people how to have a higher moral ethical standard. I don't buy into that.
Bullshit.
But that is one of the apologetic narratives against the moral epistemological argument.
He didn't have to have it in the first place. He didn't have to have these sinful things in the first place. Like, it goes back to what I said at the beginning. He can wish that away or will that away in a finger snap, and there we can go back to perfection. But he doesn't do that.
I would argue efficiency in that. What I would say would be, and you're right, but the way I would word it, I would be like, if God's trying to teach us a lessons of like of certain kind, the way he went about it seems very, very inefficient for an all-powerful, all-knowing being.
It's hypocritical and pretty damn evil. Evil would be the word I would use. Absolutely evil.
Yeah, I mean, because he's condemning. I mean, forget about even the people that just don't listen. What about the people who never heard? I mean, the millions of people in India, in Asia, in South America, in North America before the colonization. What about all those people who never had the opportunity to believe?
Sometimes they'll have it afterwards. Like there's the argument from Divine Hiddenness is one of my favorite arguments. I think it's one of the best arguments for atheists. And basically, it argues this, because I'm what's called a non-resistant non-believer. That is somebody who is not saying, "Hey, if there's a God, I don't want anything to do with him." It's like, "Hey, yeah, if you do exist, hey, come talk to me." Right? You're non-resistant, and you're a non-believer. Mm-hmm. So. The argument is such, if God wants a personal relationship with somebody, right? Then why is he not reaching out, and making that happen? It's why is he hidden from the non-resistant non-believer? And that would be somebody who's never heard of him as well, right? If you never heard of him, then you're clearly a non-resistant non-believer, because you don't know if you're rejecting or withholding assertion or withholding assent. You don't know anything about the deity, right?
Can I answer that as an evangelical?
Go for it.
Well, Steve, you see, you may think that you're seeking God, but your heart's not open. You have that doubt, and as long as you have that doubt in there, he's not going to come to you. You have to be.
Now, is that how you would have answered it?
Open your heart. That answer. Yeah.
You have to open your heart.
Because Kyle was a bigger believer than I was. Kyle was a full on young earth creationist, evangelical. Is that how you would have answered it? Really? Have you like?
Oh yes, yes. Okay. Have you not heard this? Guys in the podcast, either of you, Adam.
Told that verbatim.
Oh yes, certainly. Yeah. I mean, it's often that you ultimately you're a flawed creature that really doesn't know God. So it's on you.
You're not sincere in your search, like. Sure. Once you let down those walls, then he will come to you. But until you fully open yourself up, it's you. It's your fault.
Yeah.
It's pretty funny in a way, actually, because often it's sort of like, you try to like reason from a rational standpoint, and you talk about what credible and compelling evidence is there for to believe in this being, and someone's like, well, ultimately you kind of have to make that leap of faith. You kind of have to believe, and I'm like. So you got to believe before you can start believing. You got to kind of like, you get what I'm saying there?
Kierkegaard calls that the leap of faith.
Yeah, but that really what Kierkegaard meant by that, per se. I think they were kind of taking what Kierkegaard said a little bit. He didn't really mean that you have to believe in order to believe. It wasn't like, hey, jump off this cliff and hope that God reaches down and saves you kind of thing. Wasn't that kind of leap of faith? Yeah, Kierkegaard was trying to say, hey, you know what? Stop thinking about yourself. Stop having this introspection, and maybe open yourself up to higher consciousness of some kind. He didn't word it that way. It was kind of a Deepak Chopra, but
as if we needed another reason for to question belief. Here's like this is the number two reason why I stopped believing. Mm-hmm. You're told all your life, or at least I was in church, that it doesn't matter when. In life, doesn't matter at what point, at what age, if you choose to believe in God, no matter what you've done, you will spend eternity in heaven. Now, here's the question. I'm saying I'm God, right? I have two people in front of me that have just recently died. You have this guy who murdered two people, sexually assaulted kids. And they found him out. They put him to death, right? He's in front of me. But right before, while he was locked up, right before he died, he gave his life to God. And then I have this other guy who spent his entire life, very average life, nothing too extravagant, nothing too, didn't do too evil. He cussed and he drank and he did some drugs, but he lived a pretty average life. He just never believed in me. I'm going to send that guy to hell and let this guy in?
Yeah, can you imagine a heaven filled with Ken Hovind, G-Man, Jack Colby? Let's think about this for a second here.
Jeffrey Dahmer converted to a Christian right before he died. Ooh. Is that guy in heaven? Are you spending heaven with Jeffrey Dahmer?
After a plate of fried chicken, he repented, yeah.
And if you are you okay with that? Are you okay with him? But your family members who maybe didn't do anything bad, the only thing that they're guilty of is disbelief because there's not enough evidence. Is that really warrant? Does that really warrant you spending eternity burning in hell? I don't think so. I don't think that's rational to think that way. I think it's sick to think that way.
No, I totally agree. I mean, I think the ultimately, if you know, the belief system predicates on belief alone, then I mean, what are you really sort of like funneling at that point? Are you just gullibility? Is that what you're sort of like, you know, picking control. Out? I guess you'll have some serial killer deathbed converters too. So I guess you get some of those too. But
why not? Why not? If they're dying, what do they have to lose? They just have to say a few words and they get to, you know, spend eternity in heaven. Is that a loop? Is that really a loophole that a God, a super knowing, all knowing God would create? I don't think so.
I have an argument that you're not really this, when Athea says, look, you're choosing to go to hell. You're choosing not to accept Jesus. Or something along those lines, right? Here's the counter, like that I have. You're not making a decision to say, "Hey, I have in front of me heaven and hell. I'm looking at them. I'm seeing that they have some kind of ontology. I'm going to decide to go this path. I want to jump into the fires of hell," which, by the way, I do not believe exist. But that would be a decision, right? I have information that I can make a cognitive decision based upon the information available to me. When you're being told things from other people, most of them being very untrustworthy people, because I'm sorry, but a lot of the evangelists, matter of fact, most of the evangelists that I run into are not very, well, there's some, you know, Seigart's evangelistic guy. He's a trustworthy guy. He really believes it, right? He's not trying to lie to the people to promote his narrative, right? But there are evangelists, especially on YouTube, that lie. They outright lie to
still their wrong. Narrative.
But it's probably they're not making an informed decision, though. Right, so when Athea says, "Hey, you're deciding to go to hell," well, no, you're not, because you're not making a decision on do I go to the heaven or do I go to hell. What I'm making a decision on is do I have enough information to believe this person or this story. And by the way, you're not actually believing the story as much as when you hear from the theist. You're evaluating the credibility of the theist a lot of times.
Yeah,
sure.
And Steve, I like your counter argument. I often take a simpler route, to be fair. I often say when someone's like, "Oh, ultimately you choose to go to hell," I'm like, "Oh, I don't want to go." And they're like, "Oh, but you're gonna go." I'm like,
"Along those lines,
who's gonna send me?"
Along those same lines too is that I think to me is the top motivator for why people are Christian in the first place. If you took hell out of the equation, I don't think you would have nearly as many people who are Christian, because I don't think that on its own people would say, "No, I love this God." You know, I think it's that threat of you or your family members burning alive for eternity that motivates people the most.
Kyle's
favorite fallacy is because it's called argumentium ad baculum, which is a whale penis bone.
Right.
But it's the argument from the cudgel, meaning that believe me or suffer the consequences.
Right.
And yeah. Roosevelt's foreign policy, but on a celestial realm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then Jordan and I sort of touched on this in an earlier video, but you know, I as sort of a caveat, I'm talking out of my ass here, but I've seen like an interesting trend in religions where religions that intend to proselytize and spread the faith often seem to have a built-in system where they have it or a built-in threat, right? So for example, like choose something like Judaism, right? They're not trying to convert you. No, they're not trying to spread the faith. You know, what are the consequences for, you know, not being a Jew? Right. I mean, they don't believe in hell. So there aren't any consequences. But religions that intend to spread the faith often have this sort of, you know, back burner argument where like, "You don't believe what I said, do you?" It's like, well, you know, I have news for you. You know what I mean? If you don't believe what I just said, you will suffer the consequences of that.
Toast.
And I've just seen that interesting trend in, you know, sort of proselytizing religions.
Yes.
And I'm Jewish. By culture, my mom's Jewish, right? So I heard that Jewish people are automatically saved from some people, but you know, I have a friend, Dr. Kenny Rhodes. He's a nice theologian. He's a very brilliant man, really sweet guy. And we were talking the other day at lunch, and he said, "Steve, I've seen people die in real time. I mean, I've held them as they actually die, and I really do believe that during that moment, they're giving a chance to accept, you know, the narrative or not." Right. And I'm thinking about this. Right. And I'm like, so what you're saying is that people that, you know, live their whole life one way. If they accept at the end, they're good to go, right? And he's like, I believe there's something to that. Even after passing, he thinks that you can still be saved, right? And I'm thinking, okay, so, you know, do you think that I'm saved? He's like, oh, yeah. He's like, even though you don't believe, you know, I can imagine, I wouldn't want to believe in a God that's going to send somebody like you to hell, right? Oh. And so I'm thinking this, if I end up in hell, I'm going to be going, hey, blame him.
It's so frustrating because I like Kenny Rhodes too. Like, I like Kenny Rhodes too.
He's a great
guy. That's not what the book says.
No, I know that, but you got to admit, he's universal.
That's not what the book says. Like, you can't make that. How can you honestly say, I think that they're given an opportunity, even past death, when it says none of that?
Well, there is some standard for it. Jesus supposedly died, he went down and preached the spirits for 3 days in spirit prison, and some of them were saved, and they were. But that doesn't. It doesn't tell you if they were dead spirits or they're spirits that never lived. It's very vague on that.
Even if it did,
I would want to see those passages too. I'm not entirely convinced that's what the Bible's saying either. You know what I mean? Didn't it say he just went into the ground for 3 days?
Yeah. No, it says he went to the spirits and preached for 3 days, and I think many souls were saved or something.
I'd be very interested to see those passages.
Experience. It doesn't say that therefore gives people the opportunity once they're, you know, that may be just a one-off event that happened when Jesus went down there, because that is a pretty big deal. When that raises a different question: what did Jesus do to warrant going to hell?
What did he do to warrant death on a cross in the first place? I mean, to satisfy his father for his own father's creation? I mean,
because she ate an apple.
And don't forget, his father is also him.
Women, that's a favorite. Oh, there's another reason. What is the Trinity? What is this? What is this? God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit. They are all one person, but they are not the same.
I heard an argument that was sort of an artifact. It's not an argument, actually. It was more of an explanation. that was sort of an artifact of, because the New Testament especially is sort of an amalgamation of a lot of these different myth styles, where you have like Judaism, but you also have kind of Greek mythology and pagan myths too, and they were all sort of combined. And so that's why Jesus was sort of a demigod in a way, and also why there had to be a Trinity. It just sort of flowed more with the time. I don't remember that argument or explanation very well, but it was something along those lines.
I'm going to show you a chart that we had to know in Sunday school.
Yeah.
This is what we were told. And this is true. This is a graph that the Southern Baptist Convention put out. And this is supposed to be a triangle here.
Okay.
So here's what you have, right? The Trinity. God is the part of the Trinity. Holy Spirit is part of the Trinity. Jesus is the Trinity. All one, right?
Yeah. But
here, God is not Jesus. Jesus is not the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit is not God.
God.
But they are all the Trinity.
I have the passage for you, by the way.
I'd like to hear it.
Yeah, 1 Peter 3:19-20, by which also he went and preached under the spirits in prison, which sometime were disobedient, and whence the long suffering of God waited in the days of Noah, while the ark was preparing, wherein few, that is, 8 souls were saved by water.
So then he went to prison. They didn't say hell, right?
Well, the spirits in prison, again.
I think that might mean hell.
The concept of hell. Now, the 8 souls by saved by water, people obviously, you know, think is like the Noah's ark, but some people have interpreted it to be after death. It's, I don't know. Again, when you do these, when you're doing an eisegesis of these things, it's like you can add anything you want to it. So,
sure.
You know,
Write a simpler book. Write a simpler book.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's another thing that I don't know when I discovered this, but as soon as I did, it was shocking to me. Just like the you can't separate the Bible from how man-made it is and how man-crafted it was. I mean, it's just this amalgamation of books that have no real cohesiveness, no real coherence, or at least internal coherence. And I know I discovered at one time, I think, that the 4 Gospels were 4 of 12 possible ones. There's like a Gospel of Thomas, a Gospel of Mary.
Judas.
Yeah, Judas. There's a ton of them. And it, you know, in one, I think it's the Gospel of Thomas. Thomas paints Jesus as a boy, you know, sort of messing around with his father, lengthening certain pieces of board just as he was about to nail them in and things like that. It was just like a whimsical fairy tale of a story. And then you find out that, a lot of translations went through all these Chinese generations and were added to and subtracted. And it's all, the hermeneutics of it alone make it impossible to judge in English. You'd have to be a Greek and Hebrew and Latin scholar just to know anything.
Council of Nicaea, the Bible is composed by books picked and voted on by a group. If this is really the inspired word of God, who are they to decide which books become the Bible? It ultimately boils down to which of these books give the most credence to the principles and the rules that we want to make for society. So let's pick the ones out that lean more towards control, like with the women thing. We don't want women having their kind of place anywhere. Give me the book that tells them to shut up when they're in church or to be submissive to their husbands. And it's amazing to me to see today in an age where women are at the forefront of everything. You know, they're not standing behind anymore. They're taking their place at the table. To see how these religious, evangelical apologists turn these verses around to fit current day trends, because how do you tell a woman who is independent and strong that in church she's not allowed to speak? How do you pass that off? Or that women can't be pastors? SJ is telling Steve that she doesn't believe that women should be pastors. How do you square that with how are you a woman and okay with that? Like if that is real, how are you okay with that?
Yeah,
I genuinely don't know.
But it's like Jordan's quote earlier. I think it was, as I remember, it was like, "I shall not suffereth the woman to teach." I think
something
like that. And it's like, I can't imagine being a woman going through the Bible and being like, "Oh, okay, this seems like divine wisdom. I should shut my mouth." You know what I mean? Like it's not something that I would find compelling.
Even more harmful than that, you have pastors like Steven Anderson, who I don't hate many people, but if there's anyone that I hate Steven Anderson.
Is he the Texan pastor?
Arizona.
He's Arizona. Yeah. He's the one that all gays need to die kind of thing.
Yeah. And you know what? Not even for that. I hate him for his views on marital rape, because he got up in a sermon in front of the church and said that there was no such thing as marital rape. The Bible dictates it, that once you say I do as a marriage vow, that is consent for every time you want to have sex until the day that one of you dies. Until then, you don't get to say I don't feel like it tonight. You don't get to say I'm not in the mood, and you don't get to say no. There is no, he is preaching something that is illegal in all 50 states, because marital rape, much to his chagrin, does exist. It is a real thing. And you have people out there in that congregation, women especially, who have to sit and listen to this man who they think has been touched and ordained by God tell them that no longer can they say no, or they don't feel like it, or they've been going all day long and they don't, they genuinely are too tired to have any kind of activity like that. And they're hearing this guy tell them, too bad, suck it up. That's outrageous.
Yeah. And just sort of building off that point, I mean, if you take that to where it logically ends, that, if there is a God who, either approves or disapproves of what, this Pastor Anderson is saying, right? So if he approves of it, or I guess if he's not doing anything about what this guy is saying, does he approve of it, or is he just not going to intervene? All right. So if he's, let's say that he doesn't approve, but he's not going to intervene, then why are people gathering every Sunday to listen to to someone kind of tell them what they need to believe in life? Like, why do they need to get, sort of instructions from another human being on how to live? I've always been confused by that. It's like, why does this person in front of us know anything more than I do? I don't care if they've gone to seminary school. Yeah. Honestly, I don't care. They're reading the same passages I am right now. Yeah. Why do I need to be told?
Intervene on those things. I mean, Steven Anderson used to be real tight with Kent Hovind. He's the one that called him from jail. He's the one that got the audio recording of Kent Hovind saying that, well, I can't do a Kent Hovind voice, so maybe I'll translate when I say it, but he's on air, audio literally saying, well, I don't recommend that we kill gays, but if the government does it, then that's fine, right? That was Kent's narrative, was that, oh, well, no, I don't think we should be going out killing gays, but of course, if the government doesn't, and of course, this was big news back then, and he used to be tight with Kent Hovind, but then Kent Hovind did an abomination. He did a heresy. He left his wife.
Right. You know what's crazy? Steven Anderson has a guy that that idolizes him. He's in every movie that he does. This other guy's a YouTuber. I'm not going to mention his name because I'm not going to give Brat Towel any sort of publicity. But this guy is he's a 22-year-old preacher. He preaches in church, but he's a devotee to Steven Anderson. We've had him on our show twice, and I have sat across the cameras from him where he looked at me in my face and said, yes, the government should still be taking people like you and putting them to death for simply loving somebody of the same sex.
And that narrative is one of the reasons why I left theism. In 2008, especially, there was in California, proposition for gay marriage. And the LDS church had invested a lot of money to go against it. And I was thinking at the time, why would a church have political leanings like that? Why would a church get involved in politics? Whatever happened to secularism and separation of church and state? And why on this particular issue? And that was my breaking point. I mean, So even though I had a long transition and it really wasn't, you know, a moment where I said, you know, I no longer believe, that was at the point where I was like, okay, I'm just done with all this.
Across this country, religion is on the decline. It is tanking. It is tanking fast. And with the advent of the internet and people's access to information, it has woken up a lot of people, and no longer are people willing to be okay with the sexism, the misogyny, the homophobia, the murder, the death, the incest, just the evil and the amount of blood that has been shed over that book. That book is responsible for untold amount of death all throughout history. That's the constant. It's always had undertones of religion in almost every war, in every battle, the monarchy. How many lives were shed between the Catholics and the Protestants under Queen Elizabeth and Mary and Henry VIII? And then even as up in America, I think it was the 1600s, the Salem witch trials, because one verse said, never suffer a witch to live. Mm. How many people died and were crushed to death or hung because of that one sentence? And if you can walk away and be okay with all of that at the end of the day, if all of that's acceptable for you and the things now that are currently out there, then more power to you. I just think that you are not a decently thinking person if you're okay with worshiping a deity that's okay with that sort of bloodshed.
And it all comes down to like just the endless contradictions, right? Because you learn, you know, in a church context that, you know, God is able to touch the hearts of men. He's able to touch the hearts of men, right?
He did for Pharaoh.
Apparently he wasn't touching the hearts of, you know, those who engaged in the Salem witch trials. Apparently he wasn't touching the hearts of the priests who were, you know, molesting children, you know, from the hometown of where Jordan and I are from, actually. We're from Pittsburgh. Yeah. And that's where, you know, one of those, you know, recent, you know, Catholic, you know, sort of rape scandals emerged.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, you know, ultimately, you know, a Christian would say these things are due to the fallibility of men, right? And and you're like, okay, that's fine, but why, you know, if God is, you know, omnipresent, omnipotent, omniscient, why can't he simply, you know, inspire a thought, you know, sort of touch a heart of someone and be like,
right,
you know, and sort of impress upon someone the significance of their actions and say, these things are, you know, inherently wrong.
The devil does it all the time.
But he doesn't.
The devil does it all the time.
Yeah, but it's like, and I've actually seen in my Facebook feed, a few Catholic apologists that, you know, Jordan and I know from our high school that have been like, oh, this isn't representative of the Catholic Church. You know, these were, you know, individuals. Oh, sure. And it's like, you know, I just they don't see that contradiction of why, if God is capable of doing more, why doesn't he do more?
And why does it keep happening with the Catholic Church? This is Stephen and I's like Stephen and I go hard against Catholics on this, because we take the stance that knowing what you know, knowing and seeing from this grand jury report that your ties that you're given this organization are a certain percentage of it is being spent on relocating priests accused of this thing, continuing to pay priests accused of these atrocities. If you continue to tithe that organization, that makes you complicit as well. And I know that's a strong statement to make, but it's an accurate one, because you can take that money and you can give that money to actual organizations that is never, ever a question. Thousands of organizations do charity work that they don't have to deal with any of that stuff. But you're giving money to an organization that knowingly is shelling out money to people who have been accused of assaulting, sexually assaulting a child. That makes them complicit.
Yeah, can I? Let me read my tweet. This is a tweet that I have pinned on my page. It's been up there since August 16th, 2018. So it's been up there a while. So it's got a lot of retweets and the likes. But what I said is this, and it's a controversial thing that people they go after me for, which is fine. I want them to.
Us and controversy? No.
But it's,
yeah, we can't have that on the show.
This is what I wrote. I wrote, to every Catholic that remains within the church, you are complicit in criminal activities. If your God is a moral and just God, don't you think he would understand you taking a moral stance against injustice? If not, then your God is immoral and not worth worshiping anyways.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, very much the same sentiment over here as well.
Yeah.
And I was just going to say, Kyle,
I've actually never thought about it in terms of who people choose to give to, though. I thought that was a really powerful way to put it.
Yeah, you can give that if you're giving money because of the good that the Catholic Church does. And yeah. Number one, that is a lie in itself too, because
it's the least efficient charity ever.
One of the biggest horrors that's happening in on this planet that people are okay with seeing happen is that the Pope takes a stance on contraceptives and condoms that is killing millions in Africa. Millions of people are dying unnecessarily because of a stance on condoms. And give me good that the Catholic Church does. Give me the actual good that the Catholic Church does, and I will show you countless other organizations that can do that same thing without being okay with the murder or the endless suffering and dying of people in Africa and the assault that takes place on kids. I will give you multiple examples that can do that same work without all the bullshit that comes along with the Catholic Church.
Yeah, and the overhead for the Catholic Church. I mean, the church is worth, and this is bare bones, probably around $10 to $15 billion. Highest estimates of around $20 billion. It's not like they're in a need for funding, right? I mean, and most of that is going to opulence. Most of that's going to maintenance of buildings. Most of that's going to investments in Italian stocks. So there's a lot of things that it's not going to this charitable type thing that people think is going to. So,
Steve, how much of that did they spend on the priests and the cases against them? How much?
It was $4 billion, I believe.
$4 billion. Wow. Dollars of people's money that they, in good faith, give this organization because they think that it's the right thing to do, that God told them to do. $4 billion of that
that was paying off witnesses,
legal fees, the priests' salaries, and whatever else that they can use towards child abuse.
That's obscene.
$4 billion is going to that.
Holy shit, that's disgusting, actually.
I didn't know it was that.
It varies from 3.8 to 4. Nominal amount of difference.
$10 is too much. $10 is too much to go to that. $10 is too much to go to some guy, some piece of shit that is accused of assaulting a girl because he has the authority that they think is ordained by God. This man is from God. Who am I to fight back or tell anybody when he tells me not to? My soul might be in jeopardy. When you use that sort of power against a child, you are the most disgusting garbage human on the planet. And the fact that they're getting $4 billion, which is the equivalent to some countries across this planet, then you should be ashamed of yourself if you continue to funnel that kind of money to an organization that's going to spend it on that shit.
And we're being told that we're the hateful, bigoted ones because we're telling people you can spend your money other places.
Fine.
I mean, you can give to other organizations. There's many other Christian organizations. We're not. It's not like we're saying you shouldn't give money to Christian organizations. Right. I'm all for that if they're very charitable, right?
If Jesus is real, if God is real, do you think he's sticking around the Catholic Church after the shit that he's seen? No. He's the first person out.
No, he loves it. He's watching it right now. He's chilling there watching those scenes.
If that is true, then think about who you're going to be up there for all of eternity. I'll skip my ass happily into the flames before.
But you got to be careful on YouTube nowadays because it's so funny because these are all high level discourse, right? Nobody's condemning the individuals per se. They're saying that they're horrible human beings. I think they're just either like in the Catholic Church. I think they're just misled a little bit, right? I think they're doing well, right? So I'm not condemning the people, right? But you know, we've been called rape. What was it? What did Dean call it?
Rape apologists.
Yeah. And child victim abusers. I'm saying that because. We called Dean out on his nonsense from Red Pill Religion that all of a sudden we're abusing a child victim of child molestation. I'm like, do you understand there's no correlation there?
Why are you bringing him up? Why?
but we're being called out on that narrative. But YouTube, you know, is like very careful on what's called hate speech, right? I mean, that's a big thing on YouTube now. And yet there's nothing that we Kyle and I have said that even remotely is constitutive of hate speech.
So far we've condemned hate. Like, I don't understand that. Yeah,
we've said factual things. I'm sorry, but if you continue to give money to people who have or who are actively spending it on the defense of people who abuse children, that is complicit. Here's an example. Let me put just so there's no question. If I give Steve $5 every week, right, because Steve tells me that he needs this to eat lunch with, so I give Steve $5 every week. Well, I learn that Steve is taking that money and he is using it to buy heroin. Right?
He knows me so well.
Am I knowing that this money is going to for Steve to buy heroin? Am I complicit in this? Or a better example, if he was saving up money to murder someone, let's say I find out that he's saving up this money to murder someone, and I find out that he is going to spend this money that I'm giving him every week to have someone killed. Do you think a court of or a prosecuting attorney would not hesitate to charge me with complicity, knowing that that was murder was going to take place? You bet your ass they would. I would be charged for accessory.
I just went from drug addict to murder for hire. Boy,
but that's how it works, though. That makes me complicit, knowing that he's going to have somebody killed with the money that I'm giving him, and either not stopping to give him money or telling people what he is actually doing with this so that it can be intervened. I am complicit when that guy gets killed. It's the same thing.
I want to know what's going on inside the Catholic mother or father's head when they read another headline. Like there are people in our hometown that read about the Pennsylvania Catholics, sex scandal, right? And then the next day sent their kids to Catholic preschool or whatever. Like, what the fuck are you thinking?
I have said, and I did a poll on this, and I was like, you know, do you feel if your kids are more safer with an atheist babysitter or a Catholic priest? And still people were saying the atheist, the Catholic priest would be safer with them. I'm like, are you really going to make that argument? I mean, seriously going to make that argument? Because
it depends on the priest and the atheist. You know what I mean? Like, I think on both.
Well, Certus Paribus, all things being equal, if it's just the information you're given is that this person's an atheist and the kid's hanging out with him, and this person is
an atheist in a heartbeat.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even a question, right? I mean, I didn't think it'd be that controversial. No, I had Catholics people just going, well, yeah. No, I wouldn't let my kids with atheists. They're immoral. And I'm like, do you understand what's been going on
here's the reason to answer your question. Religion has the ingenious
marketing scheme
mechanism that it implants in someone's head. It's got this fail-safe where it tells you that the moment that you start doubting, your eternity is in jeopardy. Like, that's a huge thing. The moment that you start doubting, You need to be aware of it and that you're questioning God's role. So what that does is it traps people. People, I think, by nature are curious. People by nature question things. They want to know the answers to questions that they have. They're curious. Religion dulls that, dumbs that down, and then makes it to where if you get too curious, you're messing with your eternity here. So a lot of people continue to send their kids to Catholic school the next day because those priests were gotten to by temptation, by the devil. This is the devil's way to make us lose our faith. He wants us to say, okay, oh, there's something wrong with the Catholic Church. We need to hold our kids back because that's what the devil wants us to do. He wants us to be victim of this entire charade that he's made. The devil got to the priests, and if we go along with it, the devil wins.
And there's also this sense of community inside the religious, or at least within the Catholic Church as well. I mean, very much it's a cultural thing, and I've seen, you know, this argument sort of, you know, pushed at least twice now, where people will say, you know, the Catholic Church is ultimately, or these people, you know, who behaved poorly within the Catholic Church, they're similar to family members who are behaving poorly or have made bad decisions. They often will say, would you support those family members who have made bad decisions? You know, would you support a family member who had, you know, who was a rapist or a murderer? At the end of the day, would you still support that person? And I turn around and I'm like, well, no, I guess not really. I mean, if it was a family member that did these things, I would ultimately condemn it, condemn this person. And, you know, I would hope that they would change ultimately, that we could, you know, rekindle some sort of relationship. But I want nothing to do with them right now as a child rapist.
Yeah, you would distance yourself from them. I mean, I've distanced myself from family members, not because they've done anything heinous by any means, but because of other reasons. Sometimes there's just reasons to not associate with a certain person. And if that person's family, I don't think it makes much of a difference. If there's reasons to be distancing yourself from somebody, you do it.
It's funny you say that, Steve. Tomorrow on the show, actually, we've got a woman that faced that very same thing. She found out that her husband was inappropriately touching kids, and she was faced with the decision of turning a blind eye to it or turning him in. And we're going to be diving into what.
Yeah, that's not a show I'm looking forward to tomorrow, to be honest with you.
What came along, what goes along with that sort of choice? Because it's easy to sit here and say, oh, it's an easy choice. Because that's exactly what I would say now. It's an obvious choice. You turn that person in. I think when you're actually in that situation and your entire life, you know, is on the line, it takes a lot of bravery to do what she did. You know,
did I mishear that? Was he religious or not? Was he like a religious leader or just a guy?
He wasn't a religious leader. No. Okay. He was just we're diving into the sort of mindset that because there could be a lot of people watching the show potentially who may be in that same position, who may be having to struggle with, okay, I know this about somebody, whether it be a loved one, a relative, a friend, what do I do? And I'm hoping that maybe she will give people some good advice that will help them out in the right decision, which is making sure that person doesn't harm another child.
It's tough listening to that kind of stuff. I was having a conversation with a friend recently who was telling me that, the growing up, that they were being inappropriately touched by the boyfriends of the mother. And what did the mother do? Nothing.
Right.
It was their fault. They were dressing provocatively. They were leading them on. And it's not the first time I've heard stories like that. I mean, matter of fact, it's pretty common because I've heard it quite a few times.
Yeah. Happens a lot.
Yeah, it's of course from us looking in, you know, we have, you know, a different perspective because we can see the whole big picture rather than being in that situation. But it's difficult to listen to that. It is not easy. And I'm not a very emotional person, but even I'm like, holy crap, I don't know if I can really sit here with listen. This is so tough to hear.
Yeah, that's heavy. Wow. Yeah. I know
it's important. Your mother does that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, no, that's crazy. I know there was one.
I don't get it.
I don't want to drop any names or anything, but actually in this, I guess it was kind of a loose association that my religious affiliation was sort of like tied into. A few years ago, actually, one of the sort of like elders, or he wasn't an elder per se, but he was some sort of, you know, higher up in these organizations, there were actually like allegations levied against him. And I spent hours around this guy, like hours upon hours, and nothing ever happened with me, thankfully. But I was young at the time. I was like 10, 11, 12. And I spent like many, many retreats with this guy.
Do you believe it?
What's that?
Do you believe it? Based on your interaction with him, do you think there's truth to this?
Well, that the point that I was getting to, I mean, honestly, I'm not in a position to know. I mean, sure. I was 10, 11, 12. I don't think I was really kind of aware of what the signs would be at that point, to be honest with you. I mean, from my memories, he was a great guy. Nothing would have tipped me off to anything. But what was really interesting about it was, because, you know, my family came to me with the information about these allegations and said, hey, like, we just want to make sure that nothing ever happened with you, right? Mm. And I was kind of shocked, and I was like, holy shit, like, I never would have guessed that this guy, you know, would have been doing these things. Allegedly, of course. I don't know what the actual, you know, happened with the charges or whatnot. But what was really interesting is I said, you know, no, nothing happened, thankfully. You know, there was a moment of exhalation, and then it was just kind of gone. There was no thought of like, okay, well, why are these people who were on one hand celebrating as being like spiritual insights and spiritual guides into like helping us understand the Bible more? Why are those people also the same people who are more proportionately than the population, you know, molesting kids? And there was never that tension that was brought up. It was just, oh, well, thank goodness it didn't affect our family. And then we kind of moved on from it. It was just like it was kind of a really disturbing thing.
People don't want to be faced with that. I don't think like it's easy. Like when that's probably a genuine sigh of thankfully, you know, we don't have to deal.
Thank God it wasn't our family, but you know, thank God it was somebody else's family. Doesn't fly with me. Right.
Yeah. I agree.
It doesn't make any sense to say, thank you, Jesus, that it was some other family that got molestation going on. By the way, I was an ugly kid, so nobody ever had to ask me about that. Nobody
this can be fixed too, though. This can be fixed too. Stop with these archaic laws about priests not being able to either get married or be involved in sexual relationships. This is not something that God commanded. This was a rule that was put in place several hundred years after the church had already started going. This was not something that God passed down. This was something that the church decided should be the way that it is. And if you stop with that, I'm not saying that it would all go away, because it takes a special kind of, you know, creep to harm kids, but it can't hurt. It can only, you know, help alleviate the situation, but they're not doing any of this. They're not willing to budge on any of this because they can't be wrong. It's infallible. They're infallible.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing is I would never make the claim that there's something about, you know, religiosity that makes people, you know, attracted to kids. I would never claim that. But if you want to molest kids, where's the best place to do that? It's in the Catholic Church. Right. I mean, you have pristine access to young kids who are insanely gullible, being told that there are men in the sky who are watching them. If, you know, and if you tell, you'll be sent to hell. And if you are discovered, the church will pay for you to be, you know, shuttled from parish to parish where you can have fresh victims. Like it's appalling.
It's disgusting.
And ultimately it does go back to that, you know, ridiculous creed of Christianity where, you know, you don't have to apologize to the victims, right? You never have to be accountable to the victims. You're only accountable to God. So if you do these things to children, you don't have to turn around and tell their families, you know, apologize, you know, make reparations. You merely have to, you know, confess your sins and receive forgiveness, right? It does create that, you know, that environment where you can do pretty atrocious things and still, you know, expect to be in good favor with God.
And doesn't that piss you off? Like, if I were God, the front row seat of hell would be saved for people who use a position of authority under my name to harm kids.
I think it's even more iniquitous than that. Here's the thing. A lot of these priests were actually using this, you know, what they were doing to the children as religious moments, saying, God wants you to do this. You know, this will help you be saved. This is cleansing you. This is for your own benefit. I mean, if there's much more evil than that, it's only a small margin to the very, very bottom of the depths of humanity. I mean, that's just.
Steve, they were giving crosses. Priests were giving crosses to kids. I forget which church this was from. But they were giving crosses to kids that were the most vulnerable, so that other priests would know.
It was a symbol to them to let them know that they were more susceptible to these things.
Now, how is that guy going to be forgiven? How does that guy get to still go to heaven? But the
that's a racket. Those are planned machinations. Those are what I kept saying to me, and I know I get flack for this, but I really do honestly believe this, that the church has become an institutional crime organization.
It is. It's the mafia.
It all comes down to, I mean, just the sort of divine, spectrum of sin, right? I mean, like, you know, raping kids is pretty bad, but it's not quite as bad as not being fully convinced of the religion, right?
We could be saved for this, but you don't believe, you're screwed.
Exactly. I mean,
all sins are the same. Like, how is that true too? How is me lying to my grandmother because she asked me how her meatloaf was? I thought it was horrible, but I didn't want to break her heart. How is that the same as priests raping little kids? That's ludicrous.
There's a defeater of that too. If there's an argument that all sins are the same, that means literally all sins have to be equal, right? There cannot be an outlier to that. But in the Bible, there is an outlier. The blasphemy against the Holy Ghost is considered to be an unforgivable sin. And then what that entails, I think, it's a little more complicated than what people think.
The only one, right?
It's not just denying of God. The way I remember reading and interpreting it is that blasphemy against the Holy Ghost is having complete knowledge, having full knowledge of a deity and then rejecting him. Satan would blaspheme the Holy Ghost. But we as men can never do that because we can never have pure knowledge, full knowledge of God.
Oh, I can try to the day I die, though. Fuck you, Holy Spirit.
But if that's something that is a sin that has a different punishment, then clearly it follows logically then all sins are created equal, because now you have two categories. You have these sins and you have this sin. They're not equal. It's simple reason, right?
The blasphemy of the Holy Ghost is an interesting idea. I mean, so like, it ultimately comes down to, well, you know, if you don't know about me and you don't worship me, I'm pretty angry at the end of the day. You know, I'm pretty angry that I'm not being worshipped by you and you don't know about me. But if you know about me and you're not worshiping me, ooh, I'm very angry. You better be worshiping me. You know,
I'm very, very mad.
It says that God is a jealous God. God is three of the Ten Commandments are all about Him and worshiping other gods before Him. It's so like if you hear all this stuff, like if you are somebody that's watching this podcast and you are a believer, how can you still be at this point in the podcast? Like, how right now can you still honestly tell me that you're okay with all of this, that all of this that you've heard is, and I know that you said you had other stuff that you wanted to get to. I hope we didn't take up too much time.
No, I've been loving this. Yeah, this is a ton of fun.
But like, these are all legitimate questions, whether you think that we are, we're being too, we're bashing religion. We're not, we're stating factual events that have happened and asking legitimate questions. And I have not to this day had any answers to any of these questions, which is why I remain, I'm actually anti-theist. I go beyond atheist. I think that religion is in itself harmful and it is something that's dangerous to society. So I take it a step further.
You know what? I can tell you about what the answer to your question would be.
Sure.
So like, for instance, all of my extended family and immediate family, they're all still just as religious. I don't anymore, but when I was really, because when I was living at home, I'd go to church with my family. And when I was becoming, because, I never got baptized, actually.
Ooh, it's over for you.
Yeah, I know, I know. Because I think that, Adam, you got baptized, right? But I was the only one.
I was never baptized.
Oh, no, you were
twice. You know, really? Three times. I mean, there's how many?
I thought you were when you were a baby. To do it.
Oh, well, when I was a baby, I think there was some sort of ceremonial thing. But there, I think there's a pretty big distinction in the church between, you know, the ceremonial, you know, baptism as a child, because it not happens to everyone. But, you know, at least in my church, well, at least in my church. Heathen for life. But
I was baptized when I was a baby.
In trouble.
No, but I think there is, I mean, at least at my church, there was a big distinction where people, you know, who were coming of age would make, you know, a public profession of faith through baptism. And I've obviously never did that. So I don't know what to say when people are, you know, asking if I've been baptized, because.
No, it would be the answer.
Yeah, no would be, no. The, no yeah. would be the answer, I think.
Yeah. I've said that twice. Anyway, go ahead.
No, yeah, so I was going to say, like, because I used to kind of have these discussions with, you know, my family and be like, well, like, haven't you guys considered this? And of course, I mean, they hadn't, which is no fault of theirs, I guess. They had just never, they had never been presented with a lot of these. But so, for instance, if I, you know, went to my parents and said, hey, like, I want you guys to watch this, this video that I did with these two interesting guys and listen to it and tell me, like, how you could possibly believe at the end of this. I'd be shocked if they got through it. To the you know, first of all, but if they did, I think their response would be to undermine our credibility psychologically, just to say, like, well, you're so gleefully wrapped up in this disavowing of, you know, our creed that I think you've become, your heart has been hardened, you know, you've become.
Now, are they young earth creationist or evangelistic or what's
the... they're evangelicals. They believe in a young earth.
I'm going to say specialty just because I don't know what else to call it. But when I first got started on YouTube was debunking young earth creationism.
Okay.
This is how a lot of the Kyle and I got started. I had Cud Hovind on a few times. We were just, you know, wrecking him. and so that's something that I could, like, really address for your family. So if you ever had a video on that, you know, that's what they should listen to. They should go listen to Apologia, especially somebody like that, who makes so these videos explaining, right, why young earth creationism is just absolute nonsense. And he does a very good job because I don't know if you guys know Paul Gia very well.
We want to have him on. Yeah.
He's excellent.
Oh yeah. You should definitely get him on. He's cool.
He literally got a start on my channel. I told him, I said, dude, you're going to be awesome. You're going to be famous, dude. Trust me. And what he's doing this for though is actually for his kids. I don't know if you guys know this, but
no, I don't.
This is public information. So they're confidential. He left his wife split. And they had children, and the children are still in the church, and especially in the young earth creationism. And he was very much into young earth creationism back in the day.
Okay.
And now when he left it, he's realizing how wrong it is. He's trying to make up to that and trying to get his kids to recognize that it's wrong, because he feels guilty because of the misinformation he had put up all those years. And I think that's one of the greatest motives to have a channel that I've ever heard in my entire life.
That's incredible.
Here's the thing that I'll ask your family, though, up until this point, if they got to this point, whether they think that my heart's hardened or Steve's heart's hardened, they're not. I would ask if they could genuinely get past the, you know, what we were wrapped up in, and objectively answer these questions. Like, why is it that X, why is it that Y, why is it that, you know, the thing with the Garden of Eden, the contradictions, the murder, the God seemingly being okay with killing a general's daughter for him winning a war. Answer these questions. And if you can't, at the end of the day, answer these questions, ask yourself why. Ask yourself why you can't understand this. If God is giving you the ability to understand your eternal soul, like, what can happen with that? And supposedly giving you the steps to do so, why are the steps not clear? Why are they so vague? And then why are these steps chosen by a group of men in Nicaea to be those steps? What if there's more? What if there was other books that were supposed to go into this, but weren't chosen in this American Idol version of the Bible? Why can't you get answers to these questions? And if you can't answer that question, then I would go to answer yourself, why are you willing to be okay with all of this horrible when you don't have to be, because I'm sure your family are really good people. And if this wasn't about a god or deity, if you just gave them a fact sheet of somebody that was homophobic, misogynist, sexist, believed in slavery, they would distance themselves as far as they could from that person. Why is this any different?
Yeah. I mean, it's weird. I think because I've done almost everything I can imagine to, you know, bring up all of these counterarguments and just say like, but how, like, how at the end of the day could you ever believe these sorts of things? And the problem is that I think that the logic of these questions never actually gets touched because there's an emotional barrier to them.
Sure.
I think especially, I mean, people, I mean, my parents in their 50s and they've believed their entire lives. I mean, that's like, you know, I mean, I've known Adam my entire life, basically. At age 55, if someone just presented to me all of these things that I had never known about Adam, all of these like contradictions in how he acts and these terrible things that he's done.
He's a real ass from what I understand, right?
Yeah, he's a terrible guy. I would be so conflicted and torn as to, and it'd be so tempting, even if I was presented with strong evidence, to just disavow it and discredit it and say, yeah, I don't know, but I just can't believe it.
Yeah, it's something like that type of fact, because it's contrary to what you, the narrative that you've been exposed to. And I have found, in order to get people out of young earth creationism, is that you have to find just that one chink, that one piece of data that is just irrefutable that sets a domino effect in motion. When I had somebody leave one time, it was because they were convinced, they were big fans of Hovind, absolutely convinced macroevolution didn't exist. That was, they were done. Steve, you're an idiot. Why do you believe in evolution? Macroevolution is no such thing. And I was like, well, let me explain it to you. And we actually had a debate on it. And he literally came back a couple hours later and said, hey, you know, I just checked what you said and seems to be right. A month later, he left young earth creationism. So it's that one chink. That was his chink. Now, other people have other chinks that they might, like, for example, Ken Hovind. I've got him to admit two of his claims completely BS. And he was aware of it, and he doesn't care. That is, some other people have looked into that and went, oh.
I think what you're saying, Steve, is get rid of Ken Hovind. As long, all of your examples lead back to Ken Hovind. So
if we're
able to get rid of Ken Hovind.
I will say this, and I don't usually say things like this, but there's a handful of people, on their passing, I'm not going to mourn. By any stretch of the imagination, the world would be at a better place. And I'm not trying to be, you know, vile on that, but I have to look at the big picture. Or what's worse is when people say this, they say, well, how are you judging people? If you don't have a belief in gods, or how do you have the moral standing to question things that are in the Bible? Me, as a person who loves virtue ethics, right? And I love morality and concepts like that. I'm able to justify it and destroy them in these conversations. And they don't even know what the hell I'm talking about half the time. And you're like, well, you still don't have moral standing. I'm like, you have no idea what you're talking about, do you?
Yeah, but you do. That's what you say, Steve. You have moral standing.
I have moral standing. Yes.
No, I'm saying you're to the Christian. Oh. Okay, let's take them at face value. Let's pretend I don't have moral standing, but they do because they believe in God. You should be able to say that the God that you believe in is advocating for slavery and murder and all this other. But you're not saying that that's immoral. So where does that put the blame there?
I think that's even worse on that too. Exactly. I've said the same thing to them. I'm like, look, if God grants you these morals, and even if you subscribe to what's called divine demand theory, which is an ethical subjectivism position, God gives you the ability to formulate what is right or wrong in normal ethical theory. So if God has this ability and he's given it to you to reason and to have decisions of what you think is permissible, morally permissible, and morally impermissible, and you're looking at something in the Bible going something like the slavery or that women can't be raped in marriage, and you don't find that morally repugnant, then I don't know where you're getting your sense of morality from. Because I mean, I could understand an apologist saying, well, you know, okay, God doesn't really think those things. Okay. At least you're acknowledging that you're going to want to believe in a being that doesn't have that kind of repugnant morality. Mm-hmm. But not all those do. Stephen Anderson believes in a God where that, you know, you can't be raped in marriage. I'm sorry, that God that he worships, if that's what he's advocating, is not a moral being. It's just not.
But do you guys know the apologist Frank Turek?
Oh yes.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So okay. I was listening to you know what's that kid's name? Alex O'Connor.
Actually, O'Connor. Yeah. They had a debate on one of the best I've ever seen. Actually.
Yeah. It was an interesting talk, but I gotta confess, I actually paused it like probably. It's like an hour long, maybe like 35 minutes into it, just because I couldn't stand the conversation anymore. Because, you know, I think Alex is very smart, but Frank, I don't think he's being disingenuous at all, but I'm not sure he can honestly follow the arguments that were being presented. I don't think he was being disingenuous. I think he couldn't follow it. Like he couldn't get past the idea of objective morality. He kept saying, well, how can you at the end of the day, is the Holocaust just subjectively wrong? And it's like, well, you have to, Alex kept saying, well, given that, we value human well-being, and that's sort of like an assumption we're going off of here, human well-being through that context, of course it's objectively wrong that, people, suffered, under, for years at a time. And, he kept expanding on this and he was like, so you're saying it's not objectively wrong. And it's like, he misses it.
Sounds weird, right? And I happen to like Alex. I've talked to Alex numerous times about morality and he will listen to me. I disagree with him on a few things, but Alex has some difficulties in his ontology. I don't know if you know Rationality Rules.
I've seen a few of their videos.
Brilliant guy.
Did a response to Alex, right?
Yeah, and I happen to agree with Rationality Rules. I mean, Rationality Rules knows this stuff inside and out. I've never seen a person, a layperson, that knows philosophy as well as Rationality Rules does. So I happen to agree with him on the stance. But, I mean, it's not like Alex has it really completely wrong. He says a little bit things that needs to be pointed out. But here's the thing, because Alex told me he's a moral error theorist, which I happen to attend to as well. But a moral error theorist is not going to subscribe to more realism or even more objectivism or subjectivism. It's a different thing altogether. But what Turek does is this: he's trying to conflate objective with absolute. And that doesn't work that way. Now, I do believe objective morality can exist. Rationality Rules and Matt Dillahunty, a lot of the people believe, and Sam Harris believe, and Mr. Carrot will say this. This is how objective morality would exist. And it's not that complicated as people think it is. All it is this. If you're going to ground it in some kind of goal, like amoidia, which is human flourishing, or harms and benefits, if that's your grounding, it's called a hypothetical imperative. And a hypothetical imperative means that I'm going to be doing something that will get me to my goal that's objectively true. A moral a fact would be something along the lines of, if I want to win a race, I have to run fast. That is a fact, right? I mean, then you could say, well, what else if you don't want to run the race? Well, then you're not doing the goal that you're going for, right? So objective just means it applies to people in those situations, if those are your goals. That's what an objective moral framework would be.
What if you want to win the race by taking a car, though?
But it doesn't change the fact, though.
Did you guys see Frank
Turek? It remains the same.
Christopher Hitchens?
Who against Christopher Hitchens?
Frank Turek.
Maybe, but I'm not right.
I've seen so much Christopher
Hitchens. Oh, man. Let me
probably
tell you,
somewhere down the line.
He was brilliant. This guy asked him a question. They were doing the Q&A, and he said, why don't you just stay home? You come in and make all of these allegations against religion, and it's not harming people. It's not harming any people. Who is it hurting if I want to believe in God? And Frank Turek are there smiling, and Frank Turek goes, yeah, but where does how do you word it? Something about, like, ultimately, what does it take to be evil? Like, he misses off all these things and he says, what if all of these things are evil? Like, how do you know what evil is? And he goes, no, Frank Turek says, where does evil come from? And Hitchens looked over and he goes, religion. And the place just goes crazy. So if you want to watch, if you want to see Frank Turek get his ass completely handed to him, I mean, he takes it that entire. Yeah,
he's an apologist. He again, his goal is like William Lane Craig. They're there to win an argument. They're not there to make sense.
Well,
they use a lot of rhetoric.
He lost it big time.
Frank Turek's actually going to be on Atheist Edge coming up here soon with Jim Hall.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Steve, I've been meaning to say this for like at least an hour and a half now, but I have seen you on YouTube probably in 3 videos at this point. I recognized your face right when you came on. Like, what channels have you appeared on? I mean, I'm sure it's a ton, but.
You asking me?
It's quite notorious.
I've seen you on like 3 different episodes on
YouTube. I'm on a show called Non Sequitur Show with Kyle.
Okay. But have you guest appeared like on any?
Yeah, I've been on. Yeah, I've been on Holy Kool-Aid. I've been.
Okay. Yes, I have definitely watched.
I've been on Atheist Edge. Well, I've been in the atheist community of Austin's Discord as a guest. Visual.
He fights often with people, so you'll often see him.
I'm a fighter. Yeah, I'm a scrapper.
You'll see him.
I'm the most loved, hated person on the internet sometimes because I don't follow the narratives.
There's fires every week. Fires every week.
And this is a bold statement, but I also feel like I've actually seen the debate you held with Kent Hovind too. I think I had
12 debates that I hosted with Kent Hovind with King.
Okay. Yeah. So then I've definitely run into at least one of them. And
We had King Crocoduck debate him and destroy him. We had Bill Ludlow destroyed him. We had Arn Raw. How many times?
Oh, I watched the Arn Raw one. That was
it. Won't happen again though, because about a month ago we were supposed to have Kent Hovind come back to the show, and he was going to debate this guy named Esteban, and some things happened. It was supposed to be a Saturday night. Some things happened, and we were waiting on him to start the show. He wasn't there, so we called him. Steve talked to him, and he said, "Oh, I can't tonight. I can't do it tonight. We'll do it tomorrow. Okay, we'll do it tomorrow at 6 o'clock." So 6 o'clock comes the next day, and he's nowhere to be found. Mm-hmm. He had been sending Esteban messages throughout the day saying, "Let's do it on my channel. I don't want to do it on Nonstate." Blah, 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 blah. So we go live. Esteban's here with us. We don't find Kent Hovind. And so we're like, why don't we call Kent now and find out where he's at? Well, Kent calls in and says, "I don't know what you're talking about. I never agreed to come on your show, blah, 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 blah." Well, our lovely producer, Dave, which shout out to Dave, couldn't do it without him. He had recorded the day before and our conversation with Kent. And we proceeded to play it live to Kent there on the show. And you know what he did? He hung up.
Really?
Yeah. Hung up.
Kent, why? Wait. Wow. Wait, stop.
Yeah,
stop
but crazy talk.
It's a man of God.
It's different, though. Never, I don't think, it's a different standard when you hear him actively lie to our face and then hear him in his own voice refuting what he just did. And if you can still follow that scumball after that, then there's something wrong with you.
Wow.
Yeah, he did boldface lie. That was just it was unequivocal.
Right.
That's pretty telling.
Yeah.
To be honest though, people just they don't, I mean, I know he has, you know, probably a steady base of acolytes, but at the same time, people that I've come across tend to just stumble across his videos, right? And like I'm not gonna, you know, mention names here, but you know, someone I deeply respect who isn't, you know, well-versed in science, you know, was like, "Hey, Adam, what do you think of this?" And he like put the screen in front of my face and it was Ken Hovind. And I'm like, "Oh my God." I'm like, I couldn't like fully impress like upon him. Just like, I'm like, I don't even know where to start. I'm like, okay, well, for one, like, you know, this guy went to prison, right, for like tax evasion or tax fraud. Yeah, I don't know.
What structuring.
Yeah, I was like,
tax evasion.
I was like, okay, let's start there. You know what I mean? With this guy, but he's a notorious fraud.
So. Yeah. I don't see how there's no new argument with him or anything like that. He's not interested in changing his ways. You could take his debate. You could take two debates with Kent Hovind, in a tape, and then cut Kent Hovind out of this one and cut Kent Hovind out of this one and switch them, it'll be the same, except for Arn. Arn has the only debate with him where that couldn't happen because Arn literally asked him one question and held him by his shirt collar at that one question and did not let him move off of that one question.
What was the question?
It was the
phlogeny challenge.
Yeah, the phlogeny challenge. But it was a question that usually Kent, if it had been anybody else, would have sidestepped, moved into these examples. Dog can't come from non-dog, blah, 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 blah. But Arn was, I mean, like a maestro at pushing him against that wall, and he's not going to let him down until he gives him an – and we couldn't get past that.
Yeah, we wanted to know what was the original created kinds. I mean, here's the thing. Look, if the Ark has 6,000 some odd species, right, or kinds on it, and there's 7.8 million extant animals today, obviously between that period of time
somebody fucked up.
There's been evolution going on, there's been speciation going on, right? I mean,
yeah.
You don't get 7.8 from 6,000 without some kind of evolution. By the way, hyper
11 new species a day.
Steve, literally, 10 species a day. I have to stop you though. This is true. There are people who think that God instructed Noah to take the semen of these animals on the ark and impregnate animals once it dried out. So you're only taking one, the female.
You let the animals on pairs.
I'm just telling you what. Listen, I'm telling you what. I'm telling you what New Age people have done. They've done research. They found the ark. You know, most people believe that the ark has been found. It's frozen in ice. That's a true story. What there was a documentary team.
Mount Arafat.
There was a documentary team that portrayed this as being the real ark. The real fucking art.
Well, that was on CBS, and that mockumentary. I mean, it wasn't even, that no longer is even played because all that stuff was fabricated. The guy, I don't know if you know the story from that, but one of the guys was actually a design artist, and they made him craft a thing from the ark, a nail from the ark, and what he did was use a railroad tie that it had soaked in teriyaki sauce and some other things. And that was the proof that it was a nail from the, and so they don't play that documentary anymore. That's a true story. Go look it up. The guy that actually did it won an award because it's so realistic.
If God is real, he's looking down going, what the fuck are they doing? Teriyaki sauce, really?
Yeah. I mean, We got to admit that's pretty brilliant because they said it looked exactly like you would find from some kind of ancient thing, and the guy literally did win a creative award for it.
I wonder if the guy thinks that what he's doing is wrong, or if he thinks that he's sort of the shining knight in armor coming to God's defense. God really is real.
Good question. Is it okay to lie if it's bringing souls to Christ?
Yeah, that's called pious dishonesty.
It's called bullshit.
Yeah, they say it's a Machiavellian type thing. The ends justify the means. But pious dishonesty is a contradiction, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, there are many actors of it. I mean, like this kind of feeds into my next question here. It's less of like an intellectual question, but just more of like an opinion. Who's worse, Kent Hovind or Eric Hovind?
Eric. Technically, Kent, because if you didn't have Kent, you wouldn't have Eric. So
yeah, but Eric, I can almost guarantee Eric. I don't think he buys into any of it. I think Eric.
Yeah, he's a snake oil. Yeah, at least we know Kent actually believes this. I think
something Eric, along the lines, he believes
and,
it.
And two, Kent, just not to defend Kent Owen, because that's never what I want to do. But when he got out of prison, Eric Hovind literally kicked him out of the house and sold his business out from under him. He wouldn't sign it back over to Kent. And that takes, I mean, to your own dad,
you know, there's some crap going on there.
Yeah. That takes some shit to do that to your own dad. So
that's so interesting.
Yeah. Just quickly plugging Apologia, just cause we were mentioning it earlier. Like he covers Eric so much. Jordan, have you seen Apologia?
I've seen I'm really not as familiar as I should be. I've seen a few clips of a few of his videos. Yeah.
They're actually amazing. But whenever he follows, you know, because when he follows guys like Ken Ham strikes me as someone Ham's kind of tough to talk about because the thing is, I think he knows he's being dishonest on some level, but he's not very smart either. Like he's really just not. Like, so if you watch that guy, you're like, yeah, I can at the end of the day see how he actually is very convinced by his own arguments. Mm-hmm. But a guy like Eric, he just comes across so much as a charlatan. You're like, wow, like how does anyone watch this? That he's crazy. Like, he's an obvious liar.
Ken Ham's line, which I think is just one of the most dishonest comebacks that I've ever heard in my life. When he gets backed into a corner, he does this. Were you there?
Yeah, we've got a book, but we've got a book that tells us the answers.
Yeah,
it's so weird because like Saiten is convinced that Eric is a legit guy, and I'm convinced Saiten is legit. He really does believe this stuff, right?
He's the worst too.
I like Sly. Yeah,
I like Sly.
Oh, you guys like that guy?
Oh yeah, yeah. Sly's actually, I consider.
I hate his arguments. Don't get me wrong. I hate his arguments, and when he debates, it's annoying. And we've told him that. But as a person, I felt the same way as you did before actually getting to know him. But like, he genuinely believes this stuff.
Yeah.
And outside of the debate or whatever, he's a pretty nice guy. I mean, he's really nice.
You don't even talk about religious stuff. He's actually cool as hell. But he's changed over the last 10 years. I think he wisened up. He learned that the old Psi 10 stuff, I mean, he still does precept, but the method that he was back then was very, very much more aggressive than he has now. I think he's reeled it back a lot. But he does really believe that Eric believes this stuff, and I disagree with him on that. I think that I think Eric's bullshitting him too.
No, no way.
Okay, so you guys not know Psi 10. Okay, so
he's been on several times.
Okay, yeah, I talked to him quite often on Twitter. We just kind of kick it.
He's been on the show about seven times total, I believe. And like Steve said, we'll talk in the. That's where I actually got to know him.
He's on the Discord, doesn't he?
I don't know, but he's a hell of a nice guy.
Okay, so you guys think that when he pushes these presuppositionalist, arguments, you think that he thinks these are good arguments?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
I'm absolutely convinced of it.
They're horrible arguments, but he genuinely thinks they're good. Yeah.
Oh my. Okay. I'll take your word for it.
He's a true blue believer, but don't underestimate Sai. Sai knows the topic. He does know how. Matter of fact, what's funny is when Sai actually talks about some philosophy stuff, as far as like, justification of this stuff, he actually is pretty spot on. And what he'll do is like, he had a great discussion with Shannon Q, if you know her, Apologia's girlfriend, one of our favorite people, and they had a great dialogue. They really honestly did. And you see, if you really listen to that, you can see a change a little bit in Sai's approach. He was really trying to explain to Shannon certain things like Hume's problem of induction and a few other things, and he was spot on correct. He was right? He wasn't trying to manipulate her. He wasn't playing a game of gotcha. He wasn't running a precept script. He was actually wanting to help her. And Shannon recognizes now. We've actually had a discussion the other night with Shannon on this. But if you listen to it, it's a very different type of approach than he takes in somebody where he's trying to run a thing against an atheist, where he's just trying to shut them down, because that's what precept is. It literally is to shut down the atheist. As Greg Bonson has said, presupposition has one purpose, is to shut the mouth of the atheist. That's what it's for. It's not an argument.
And it don't work.
It's not an argument. Yeah, it's not an argument.
When he says that he worries for your soul, like when he tells you that, when he says that, I'm praying for you, and he genuinely 100% believes that. Because I've had some pretty deep conversations with him, and I'm convinced that he genuinely believes that what he's doing is to benefit other people. They may be annoying arguments. I've told him this as much, that I think, I'll even pick with him. Like, he'll say something, totally unrelated to debating or whatever, and I always follow it up with, could you be wrong about that, Sai? Which is his, like, tagline, could you be wrong about that? But yeah, he's genuinely, I think, a decent guy. He's not the image that I have of him before meeting him. I think that happens often. You might get SJ is another one. She has quite the
she's a character.
Yeah.
But for example, look at Slide 10. They look at something like Darwin's Deity, right? Darwin's Deity is a pre-supper too. Darwin's Deity is the most is pretty much as base level as you get. He's one of the most.
He's the worst human being on the planet.
Do you guys know? Have you guys heard that name before?
Darwin? I have not actually.
Okay. No.
I'm not going to go a lot of detail on him. I tell you this: they has a whole channel on YouTube against him all his fuckery, all his mistakes, all the time he actually argued this. You guys are a philosophical channel, so you guys would probably know that he actually argued that affirming the consequent was a rule of inference that was logically valid. Right. He actually argued that a fallacy was valid. This tells you his.
Please watch him. Please watch him. If you do anything before, please watch Darwin's Deity. You will get so
pissed
off. I have broken my computer so many times listening to that. Just
Adam loves that. He's such a masochist.
I am a masochist. I love just getting angry, but it's like such a terrible character trait.
Dawkins is your guy. Darth Dawkins is your guy.
Darwin Thede, Darth Dawkins, Evolution Falls, Dancing with Hyenas, Duncan Dawkins.
Duncan Darwin.
But his narrative is not to educate people. His game is to give a game of gotcha, right? He wants to expose you for being a philosophically naive white belt kind of person.
Okay.
Which, by the way,
sophistry.
I cream him.
He doesn't even believe in God.
No, he believes in God.
No, he doesn't. That whole thing with that whoever doxed him or whatever was able to somehow show that he does not. He's just doing this for fun. He's doing this to troll.
I don't know. I know what you're talking about. I know who did that. But anyways, long story short, Darwin's Dockety, to tell you how duplicable Darth Dawkins is one time he actually went, and this actually feeds into Kyle what he said about trolling. He actually went into a Minecraft hangout of kids playing Minecraft, right? Kids, like 9 and 12 year old kids, to explain to them the laws of logic and presupposition. And it got so bad that one of the kids actually said something along the lines of, "Dude, go fuck off and eat raw spaghetti."
That's what he said. Like, well, eat raw spaghetti. I have so many questions about that insult.
It was like, okay. That was it. Go eat raw spaghetti. But who does that? Who goes to a Minecraft video? Kids playing Minecraft.
Wow.
Well, what do you think of the laws of logic? How you justify the laws of logic? How do you know that?
Whatever. It seems indicative of an empty person, to be honest.
I do believe he trolls. Oh yeah, he's one of the greatest trolls of all time. But does he actually believe this? I do. I'm convinced that he absolutely does. His son disowned him. I mean, his son said he's a prick. He's a troll.
I don't believe it. I don't believe it.
Well, he's a troll. I mean, that's a fact.
Oh yeah, I don't believe he really believes in God or whatever. Because when people here's the thing that pushed me to that. When people ask him, well, how about let me ask you some questions about your faith? He stumbles and falters like a
because he doesn't have to justify his own faith. He has no idea. Yeah,
but he doesn't even try. He doesn't even try.
He's focused so much on the offensive then that he neglects the defensive.
Yeah, the whole strategy for presuppers is always keep the other person answering the questions. Because if you're answering questions, you can't really ask them, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
That's the whole narrative that the presuppers, especially Darwin's.
It's a game to him. I want to show how I sound like I know exactly what I'm talking about. And
he doesn't.
I know. He's full of shit.
And there's actually a list. I don't know what happened to it, but there was actually a list of 28 questions that he will not answer, that he refuses to answer. And the reason being is because he's been doing this so long from the Pal Talk days way back when, that they've compiled these list of questions that if he were to answer any of them, it would basically be a contradiction from something else that he said. And he knows it. And this is why what happens is if you ask him any one of those questions, he'll say, oh, you're on my troll list. You got that question from these, and therefore I'm not going to answer it, and you're done.
Fuck you, dude.
That's how he plays the game. I watched him one time talking to Ozzy and Malpass and a few other people, and one of the questions was asked by, I think it was a realistic nihilist, a legitimate question that would have been a follow-up question from the line of questioning, right? Usually when you have some kind of interrogatory, you know the next question is going to be a natural progression that has to be asked, right? We've had these discussions. Mm-hmm. But one of the guys that was on his troll list had asked the question. And he's like, well, I don't answer the question of people on my troll list. And Ozzy said, well, you know, I was about to ask that exact same question. So can you answer it for me? And he said, Darwin's like, well, no, because you got that question from him and I don't answer the questions from troll. And Ozzy's like, wait, are you for real? Ozzy doesn't curse us on camera, but this is not the most time I really wanted to say, are you fucking for real?
It seems like a very weaselly way to questions that are it's very actually religious. I mean, you have certain questions that can't be asked.
That's a good way to put it. Weasel.
Yeah.
Weasel. Jordan, have you seen any Psy-10? Psy-10 Brugenkate?
Maybe, but to be honest, nothing's coming to mind.
You know who he is? He did a debate with Matt Dillahunty, another excellent debate.
Could you be wrong? That's his thing. Could you be wrong about that?
Yeah, okay. Jordan, his game ultimately comes down to he questions how you can know anything, and pretty much like he questions the pretty much the fundamentals we have to take, we have to assume, right? For example, that we can learn things, that we can trust our senses. Ultimately, he questions you on those things, breaks it down to a point where you say, well, ultimately, you know, I do have to trust that, you know, my senses are valid, that I can, you know, glean information about the world. And then he says, and then you kind of turn it back on him and say, well, don't ultimately you have to do that too? He's like, not unless there is someone that knows everything that gives you that information. It's like, don't you see what's wrong with that? Like,
yeah, how do you, exactly what he does.
Like, don't you know that? I mean, couldn't you be deceived? Like, you don't know everything. Like, how do you know that?
God tells him a way that he can't be wrong. And it's exactly what it is. There's Hume's problem of induction is something that goes along the lines of you can't use induction to justify induction. So how as the quote non-believer do you justify the use of induction? The answer is you can't, and that is true. He is right on that. Mm-hmm. But he's in the same boat. But what he does is says, oh well, you can't justify induction, which is true. But he says, well, I have somebody that tells me the uniform of nature will never change. Therefore, I can justify the use of induction because he's telling me, the all-knowing one, that the laws of the universe won't change, the laws of logic won't change, and therefore I can know that the uniform of nature is true. Therefore, I don't have a problem with Hume's induction, which is obviously crap, right?
Of course. I mean, it always happens to be the god of their cultural upbringing, too. I mean, notice that.
I mean, if that was so simple to solve Hume's problem of induction, then why isn't he writing a paper on it and putting it out and going, oh, look, I've solved Hume's induction. I can actually justify it. God. Yeah, that's not going to fly well in the philosophical circles.
So I know, you know, Steve and Kyle, you know, have a soft spot for this guy because I know him in person. But if you listen to this guy, he's infuriating.
If you want to see the best debate with Side 10, where he really gets, I think this is the debate where he lost the most. Watch him and Alex Botton. Alex Botton really, really, really takes it to him in that, and I think shows the ridiculousness of the precept argument. So that's
precept's cool. Pretty much dead. I mean, one of the precept when it first came around was big. Whenever you're in a hangout, precept had to come in. So a group of us got together: Floyd FP, myself, Foul Talkers, Jack Angstrike, a whole bunch of people, and we're like, "This we were going to." I learned the arguments, and then show people how to dismantle presuppositionalism. Mm-hmm. And how many presuppers do you see around any longer? Oh wait,
But you know, correlation isn't causation, Steve.
Correlation isn't causation. That's true, but I can tell you there was an influence there because people
argument have authority.
People have listened to our discussions with preceptors and go, holy crap, they got annihilated. Because once you know their script, it's not hard. It's really the problem with precept is when it first came around, people didn't know these things, right? And they were getting their ass handed to them because they didn't know how to respond. But now it's just a game.
Steve, here's the problem, though. Like, the presuppositionalist arguments are destroyed daily now. But my main issue is, they found a new audience. They do these street interviews where they ask, you know, random people who haven't deeply on these topics.
Yep.
And they, you know, kind of
beat up street epistemology.
Exactly. Yeah. They beat them down with these, you know, poorly constructed arguments, and their own audience is very impressed with it. They're like, wow, you know, like they sound pretty good to me. You know, it's like, and that's what kills me. That's what really ends up.
No, you're right. No, and by the way, I've seen one or two of those, but if you have a link of a channel that actually does a lot of those, please send it to me.
You're on that channel, actually. Well,
your preceptors that go out? No, the ones that actually go out and do that, the preceptors that do
I used to do street epistemology, actually.
Not street epistemology. No. Precept street epistemology. No, I mean, I know Anthony Magnaposco. I had some concerns with street epistemology very early on,
and I go back and forth on it.
And I wrote to him a very long thing of my analysis on street epistemology, and he was very receptive of it. And I think they implemented a few things, and I like what they do. I really do. Mm-hmm. I just think that there were some issues I saw epistemically, and Ozzy saw, and a few other people saw. But Anthony has a great heart. I mean, he's one of the nicest guys you ever want to talk to.
Oh, he's a sweetheart. Yeah, he's
oh my God. That guy, I want to see him pissed off once.
I don't think it can happen. I don't think his brain is wired that way.
I think you're right.
I literally don't think he has the capacity.
Just, He's just even keel. So, and I mean, I admire that. I don't know how he does it.
I don't have it. But, yeah,
I have enough.
I think he's got a good thing going. What he did was he took Peter Boghossian's model. And he got rid of some of the shit stuff with Peter Boghossian's model. I'm not a fan of Peter Boghossian.
Whatever worked for you, I think. You know, there's a place for all of that. I think ultimately, mm-hmm. just depends on who it is you're interacting with and what they will.
I binge watch that stuff. I binge watched his videos. I couldn't get enough Peter's methodology. I was like, this is fascinating.
I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, I go back and forth on it. The episode right before you guys, the episode before the one before you guys is I talked with a current street epistemologist. Well, I guess quasi. But he was a guy who was deconverted by an Anthony Magnabosco video. It was about a year and a half ago, something like that. He mm-hmm. was a Christian who was actually like deconverted in real time in one of his videos and then started a channel of his own. And what's that?
Was it good for him?
Yeah, it was a really cool thing to hear about. I don't know. I mean, I guess I don't disagree with it at all, but maybe it's just not something that I personally am interested in. I don't know.
Well, let me tell you something. I won't go into the technical stuff what my critique was, but the big picture, which is very, very basic, is that I find that the people doing these street epistemology aren't familiar with epistemology. And they run the problem of basically doing the same thing a preceptor would doing is basically asking bad argument questions. And basically, if a person's going to change their position because you're giving them a bad argument, are you really effectively changing their position, or is it some temporary thing? And then they go, oh, later. Oh yeah. And I thought about that. That was really a bad argument. And they change their position back. Right. Mm-hmm. Which is a concern, but Anthony knows how to ask the right questions. I watched a video one day of his, and he asked a question that I too am thinking all the time, and yet nobody brings it up. Right. But and I word it a little bit differently, but he asked a question to people that believed in rocks having energies, right? And rocks are amethyst, right? And I used to work. Not what? Work, I used to help out at a metaphysical bookstore years and years ago.
Oh man!
So I was into the crystal stuff a little bit, a little bit. Years ago, this is going back time. I had a pass, people. I had a pass. Leave me alone.
Oh my God!
Kyle doesn't know about this stuff, so this is like
we know. Oh my God!
But the question,
Steve, no.
Way forward, things have changed. Yeah, I used to wear a little crystal, but anyways. So,
oh my God,
the person, Anthony, you're a young Earth creationist.
Rocks can heal me.
Yeah, that's a fair rebuttal.
Don't you judge me?
Yeah,
no, I know. I didn't really believe that much. It wasn't like that. But long story short, he asked a question. He said, "What?" Gives these powers to rocks to make them do what you think they're going to do. For example, hematite for blood. What makes it such that case that it has that empowerment, right? And they couldn't answer that question because there is no answer to that question.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
Now, there's no objective thing by which this rock must do this effect.
This makes sense though, because I asked Steve a question last week because Steve was having an argument with somebody over whether or not
objectively rocks, Dan, by the way, he was thinking of, I'm sorry.
Rocks were atheists. He was having an argument with somebody about whether rocks were atheists. And I'm sitting here going, what? Who gives a fuck? What if
you can't personify rocks like that.
And now it makes sense though. Now I understand that you were genuinely concerned with those rock souls back when.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, I have.
Steve, tell no one else that story. Okay.
I have a logical proof that if you do this, then rocks are atheists. There's atheists out there that actually argue rocks are atheists. I argue against that. I think to say that a rock is atheist is one of the silliest things I've ever heard.
So
I
call them rock atheists.
Who says that? She has an argument. Rocks are atheists. Chairs are atheists. Plants are atheists.
Rocks are rocks.
Yeah, you truncate that. I tried to convince her of that. She won't listen.
Who is she?
Dr. Jones tried to convince her of that 4 years ago. She didn't listen.
Who is she?
Kate. Planet Dance.
Oh.
She's a firm believer that rocks are atheists.
Rocks are not atheists. Rocks are rocks.
I get that. And everybody who knows this topic gets that. But she's adamant about it. I don't understand.
I don't
let that let go. To me, that's a bad atheist argument. That makes me, as a non-believer, look bad.
Yeah.
When somebody's saying, hey, rocks are atheists. Well, what?
It doesn't make – I don't – like, I am me. You know what I mean? Like, I don't let other people speak for me or like, because the thing is, atheism is not a, it's not like a religion. You know what I'm saying? Like when somebody in the church does something bad, it may look bad on the church because you're all members of that congregation together. You're all follow the, those same things. With atheism, it's only one thing that we all have in common. You know what I'm saying? Like when they do something, it doesn't look bad on me because the only thing that I have in common with that person is our, you know.
I get that, but as a whole, right? But still, I mean, this is one community, and you're all right. I mean, one thing that all atheists, they don't believe in God. That is ubiquitous between any way you want to call it.
Yeah, everything else is different. There's
differences, and obviously, you know, I have a different terminology. I go by philosophical terminology. I don't know if they know, but yes, I don't even identify as an atheist. I am an agnostic.
Oh, I'm sure they know. The world knows.
Oh, I don't think they do, but still, we're non-believers, right? That's the key part, non-believers. So when somebody's making very bad arguments to a theist, I just sit there and cringe because I'm like, holy crap, do you understand how bad this argument? And this theist is just, what do they think? And they're like, this guy is just, wow, they don't know what the hell they're talking about when they're making this kind of bad argument to me.
No, it's just like, if they want to know what I think, they can come ask me. But
that's how I do it too, right? I don't
think that rocks exactly are anything other than rocks. Yeah. I don't think that they are vegan. I don't think that they are
vegan rock.
They are homosexual.
Kyle, are we ever going to do that? Because I got to tell you, there's some vegans on Twitter that are just the most obnoxious, I guess, in your face. Are you doing something with that? I mean, I don't mind if we do. I'm not vegan. I'm never going to go vegan. I do
what's
like
his face. What's his face is coming on?
Did you have a vegan coming on? They're yeah, so in your face.
The guy that wanted to talk to you about it.
Oh, that guy. Okay, so yeah, he's. I know who you're talking about. I'm happy to have these conversations. I don't want to debate a vegan, but it's just like, wow, are they?
It doesn't have to be a debate. It has to be a conversation.
Yeah. I'm not giving up my bacon, Kyle. What's wrong with you?
It's weird. I mean, I'm not a vegan and don't really plan to be one either, but they do have a sort of ethical foothold on at least the factory farmer. I mean, I think
I get, by the way, I get ethical veganism. I do. My sister is an ethical veganist.
They have so a point and they're right. Yeah. I mean, they're right.
But see, the thing to fix though is the treatment of the animals, right? Mm-hmm. That I do agree with, right? They should have the humane things, no question about that. That is an ethical consideration. But here's my concern. If all that stuff was taken care of, right, even if there was a very humane way to kill an animal, they still wouldn't think people are right for eating meat. So at that point, you're not really satisfying.
I mean, I tend to agree with them. I think that I consider myself an absolute hypocrite in this department because I'm one of those people that dive bomb for the remote when the Sarah McLachlan commercials come on and they're playing Arms of the Angel. And like, I can't look at that stuff. I can't. Yeah. And if you told me that I needed to shoot an animal in order to eat, I couldn't do it. Like, I physically could not pull that trigger.
Yeah, I'm a Bambi killer. I fish, though. I do.
But yet I'm okay with eating meat. That makes me a complete hypocrite. I completely agree with.
I don't particularly think so. Not. But I'm not going to go out and kill a deer. I couldn't do it either.
I'm a complete hypocrite. Yeah, but we're okay with somebody else doing it.
Oh, I'll eat the crap out of venison. Yeah, I'll eat it.
That's what makes us hypocrite. I think that's, they're right.
Yeah. Have you ever hunted cow or ever fished?
No, I refuse. I refuse.
Are you fishing?
Do you have an ethical argument against it?
Yeah. I've been fishing, but when I was little, but now that I'm, I'm older, I can do that. Not even to something about the fish coming out and like trying to breathe for air. It just makes me like, I can't do it. I'm too.
I don't judge anybody for that. I really don't.
Yeah. I can't. Can't do it.
That's weird. Cause I honestly plan to after I graduate, get way more into hunting and fishing because I think it's an ethical foothold above at least what I'm currently at, which is just a total 100% hypocrite doing ethical unethical buying of meats that were factory farmed.
Yeah. There's a point to be made for that. Right. I mean, the factory farms, there's problems with, nobody's going to disagree with that, but if you hunt for your own food and you do it humanely, I don't have a problem with that. As a matter of fact, sometimes it's beneficial too because of overcrowding of the herd.
Yeah. But
are you really
going to just completely hunt all of your food from, I mean, we're still going to at some point.
I, you know what? If I had to, I would
be a part of that factory thing. anything.
You're a glamper, so you're not going to understand this mentality. I can live off the land. I wouldn't mind going to a cabin and be up there for months at a time and just hunt fish, berry forest.
I'm totally with Steve on this one.
I love that stuff. I love mountains.
Not to go.
Look at me, I'm already halfway there.
Not to go like full blown hippie or whatever, but like this is just genuinely how I think. Mm-hmm. They didn't ask to be here, just like we didn't ask to be here. There's no way I could go up and in a hunting situation shoot a deer because you know what I mean? Like, because that's ultimately what it is.
What happens if it was suffering, you found it caught in a trap?
Suffering, that's different. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That minimizes.
I think that's just the goalpost a little bit.
Yeah. That's not a question. Just like I would do a human that way. There are humans that are suffering all around the planet that I think legal euthanasia should be an option.
I am very pro euthanasia.
People shouldn't suffer. Animals shouldn't suffer either. Especially when you have animals that have the same sort of, or similar cognitive abilities that humans do. Like pigs, they say, are very much
they're aware. Close.
And we're putting them in cages called gestation cages where they can't turn around. They have to spend their life in a position where they can't move. They can't turn around. It happened in New Jersey. There was a big bill up against this. Now, that's just
awful. No, I do agree with that 1,000%. But you know the people that are arguing against things like ethical euthanasia? Hardcore religious people you can't take a life. I had this discussion on when I was with one of SJ's friends, and I mean, I was appalled. I was like, so you're advocating for the position that if somebody isn't suffering, that somebody's not going to live, they're dead, basically. There's no hope for them. I mean, you were exposed to 5,000 ranking, you're going to die. Okay,
Terry Schiavo.
Not going to happen, right?
Terry Schiavo.
So the ethical thing to do from a higher moral vantage point, right, is to kill them, basically to allow them to die more, painlessly, morphine or whatever. It's not to prolong their suffering. For what? I asked them, what is the gain that they're getting for a couple more days of life in agony?
Mother Teresa, Steve. Suffering brings you closer to God.
Exactly.
Kyle,
that pisses me off, though. That's one thing that is my trigger.
Yes, sir.
I don't like when people make people suffer like that. That's
yes, sir. Okay.
Do you give any credence to the happy cow argument that if a hunter goes out, I guess it's not a cow, it's a deer in that case. But if a hunter goes out into the woods, state of nature, and puts down a deer with an ethical shot, it's a quick death. It's probably a better death actually than the deer would get in the wild.
That's true.
Dying of a disease or starvation or being torn apart alive by wolves or something. And on balance, that deer lived a happy deer life, by any metric. Do you think that that's a less ethical, or I guess less unethical, or maybe even a positive net experience for the world?
I guess what I would do is probably contrast that with myself, and say that the what if the roles were reversed and I have the possibility of getting hit by a bus or ending up in a car accident or dying of cancer or any other kind of accident, especially if you're like a construction worker or whatever, it's amplified. You could fall off, get heavy machinery. So would it be okay for a deer to take me out at this point in life and say, because I've lived a relatively happy life? And I would not be okay with that. I go forward in life from this position now, even with that threat of things happening to me in the future, because I still want to, at base level, continue to live. And I think that would be the same. I mean, with the deer, I have no way of knowing how it's going to meet its end. Maybe it continues to be a happy deer. It's in a good location and it just dies of old age.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Have you ever heard of Memphis Meats?
No.
It's this really interesting company. It's like a technology startup company that is, they've already successfully honed in the technology to artificially grow meat cells in a vat.
Yes, I have heard of
like
this.
Like you're brewing beer, basically.
Right.
And it's still super expensive. It's like $10,000 for a meatball or something. But
what?
So it's not. It's,
what?
Well, because it's it's in experimental phases right now. So it's they don't have it.
I want to try a $10,000 meatball.
Yeah, I mean it's basically it tastes like a regular meatball, I guess. But
it's a good idea.
Yeah. I mean, do you have any ethical qualms with that?
No. And I think that not only that would solve so many issues, not only would it solve the mistreatment of the animals, but it also could be a step towards curtailing hunger around the globe. If you're able to produce this on a mass scale, you know what I mean? Like you could grow infinite amount of this product without having to wait for the cycle of, a cow and the numbers that come with that and the mistreatment that come with that. I think it's a great idea.
There's actually this thing called what it is a 3D printer that prints steaks now. They'll print a steak out. It's supposed to take pretty similar to meat.
And we should be at the point in the society where you're able to take that steak and take a big scoop of THC infused butter and slather it all over it. Because
that's one hell of a meal.
Marijuana needs to be legalized nationwide.
We totally agree
on that.
I don't know why it isn't at this point. I mean, I heard they're introducing a bill on the federal level to remove it from a class one scheduled drug that may pass this year.
I don't even smoke anymore. I'm simply doing it for the monetary benefit to the states. This could benefit our state tremendously in terms of it answers all kind of questions. Like we should be in a position because nobody that wants to smoke pot isn't smoking pot now because it's illegal. I can guarantee you that. I can guarantee.
Of course.
So make money on it.
Well, and also, I mean, tax it and regulate it so it's safer for people. Yeah, I mean, it's the thing is, no one's ODing on weed. They're ODing on like Windex that slipped into it or whatever, just to because it's not regulated. It's ridiculous.
If you have alcohol legal in this country, with alcohol is dangerous as fuck. Yes. There are it amplifies domestic abuse, general abuse, car accidents. It is a devastating substance. If that is legal, then you're gonna not have something like marijuana. Which the worst that happens when you smoke marijuana is you drive half the speed limit. Like that is I said that as a joke in a debate that we did a weed debate that we did with actually it was SJ, and SJ got back with me the next day and said, I checked out your comment about the driving slow. Turns out that's correct. There were more tickets written for people going under the speed limit than
they overcompensate.
For the most part, harmless drug. And yet we're so hypocritical when we're allowing alcohol to remain legal. I don't get it.
I don't understand it either. And I mean, it's weird because I mean, the crux of a lot of Republicans, but especially libertarian arguments is based on personal freedom. And I mean, unless the harms are so egregious as to outweigh, the freedoms that we should be giving people, which they're not, I don't understand why there's not a Republican uprising of support for these things. It would generate more revenue. You can tax it. I don't understand.
Let me give you a bit of visual though, real quick. Okay, let's take John Boehner when he was in Congress as the Speaker of the House. You would see him all the time crying like a baby over something. He would get tearful, and he was so miserable. He's like Eeyore. The moment he gets out, look at what he's doing now. He is in charge of a company that grows marijuana, and he is in a magazine smiling like there's no tomorrow. So don't tell me that that there is a reason why marijuana should still remain illegal. Because did John Boehner all of a sudden lose his moral high ground? Did he have him in the first place? What happened between him being in Congress and him getting out? Money. Somebody paid him enough to get him to oversee a company that deals with marijuana, and he goes smiling all the way to the bank. So what is it? You tell me.
Yeah,
and I think I like the way you put it. I mean, it's basically autonomy versus societal impact, right? And they have to be weighed. And I don't see a impact on society with pot of any real consequence. Nowhere near what we have for alcohol.
More Doritos manufacturing.
I mean, slightly less productivity, maybe, but
I believe that drug dealers. I used to say this joke. Because I used to do stand up on the side when I was in college, and one of my favorite jokes I used to say is, I think that drug dealers should start selling, like if you really wanted to capitalize in your neighborhood, if you really wanted to be like the top seller, shoe stores sell socks, right? So you should sell stuff that complements your product. So if a dealer ran around with one of those big boxes with fun size packages of chips like Funyuns and Doritos and stuff, he would be the number one guy called, because you know that every time you get a dime bag, you get, you know, two Doritos and a Funyun.
You know, I was on Pimp Monk's show yesterday morning, or this morning, actually this morning, and I had told him that you used to be a comedian, and Pimp goes, Kyle used to be a comedian? I'm like, yeah, you didn't know that? He's like, yeah, I didn't know that. I never heard him say anything funny.
Yeah, I knew that sort of this point. That's get some new material, Pip Monk.
Pip.
I believe you were a pastor in a past life, though, Kyle.
I wanted to be.
I would totally believe that. I could see
it. I couldn't imagine.
I wanted to be.
I never got into any of that where I wanted to evangelize to people.
I still think I evangelize to some extent on things that I'm passionate about. But people say that all the time. You know, he's preaching again, is what they say. That's just because I am passionate about things and they animate me, and I don't hold back, and I don't apologize for, you know, how it comes across or anything like that. I'm just me, you know. Sometimes I have no filter. I try to be tactful. Sometimes it doesn't work out that way. Sometimes I say things that are emotionally fueled and charged, and I'm okay with that because people are emotional. You know, we all feel and we all react, and you know, I'm unapologetic and relentless on that aspect. So I wanted to be a preacher growing up, for sure.
I could definitely. I think you have the skill set for it.
Should I go back?
What's that?
There
you go.
You know, I'm going to say no to that one, actually.
Come to the altar.
Yeah.
Unburden yourself.
You can lapse into it way too easily.
I could have made more money. I could have made a lot more money.
Yep.
Oh, hell yes. Oh, can you imagine if we were like flat earthers, man? Oh, man, we'd be making.
Oh, no, I'm talking about being a televangelist, Steve.
It doesn't matter. We deal with televangelists.
Give me your donations. I love Robert Tilton. He's the best. Because he used to say, I'm praying right now. I'm praying that God's telling me $1,000 right now. He's telling me, and don't hold back from God. Plant this seed today, and salvation is yours. I'm like,
I'm feeling the whole thing.
That's
amazing.
The best slip up of that guy is when he appears and he's like, Satan gave me this message. And he's like,
yes.
that was a lie of the devil.
Or he's infamous for we've seen midgets grow. He says, we have seen midgets grow.
Have you seen the one? Every time you give a donation, Satan gets a black eye.
Have you guys seen the farting preacher video?
Oh yes, yeah.
I know Kyle has.
No, I haven't.
It's great.
Yeah, it's Robert. Go watch the farting preacher. It is one of the most funniest videos of all.
You know, Robert Tilton does these facial expressions. It's great.
Or the one guy who like strokes that metal rod in front of his congregation.
You've seen
that one? Or he's like, oh, it burns like fire, and he's like, yeah. Everyone's like so uncomfortable in the congregation.
There's another guy that like bitches out his congregation for a guy yawning. He's like, don't yawn in my church.
Oh yeah, I've seen that one.
don't yawn in my church.
That's incredible.
Listen, don't talk to your congregation that way, okay? Your numbers are dwindling, and you're going to need them. So, the best one though, this is the last example I'll give you. But his name is I think it's Dwight, maybe. I don't know. I'll DM you the link because it's worth watching. But he's got this woman on stage with him, and it's his wife, and he says my wife's a slut. God told me that my wife is a slut. Now, what's happened is this pastor has hit dementia, and nobody has the heart to tell him that he can't preach anymore. This is not his wife. This is his secretary up here. His wife had died previously, but he's calling his secretary a slut as his wife. And he goes on this 30-minute rant about my wife's a slut. How would you feel if God gave you a wife and he gave you a slut?
Pretty damn good, actually. I don't know.
You have to send me that video. I will have to watch it. Yeah, oh my god. Oh, I'm sorry to. I think we have to wrap it up. We've been going for almost 2.5 hours, but I've enjoyed every second of it. You guys definitely have to come back on.
That's sure. Great. I appreciate.
This has been great.
We'd like to have you both on our show too.
Yeah. Next time we'll do a crosscast or whatever, or just come on your show or whatever. Yeah. Oh, this has been a ton of fun.
We'll bring you on. You guys. Not every show that we do like deals in sort of discussions or anything like that. But with you two, like with you having philosophy backgrounds, is that something you'd be interested in? Like if we got somebody that was maybe a young earth creationist or whatever, you could maybe have a discussion?
Sure, sure.
Yeah, I think Adam and I are game for anything.
Sure. Maybe do a toe on too then. That'd be cool.
Yeah, that'd be a ton of fun. All right, well, before we close out, do you want to tell all of my listeners where they can't find you?
Right. Yeah. Don't go searching for non sequitur. You'll never be the same. So save your sanity. Don't subscribe. Go about your daily routine without inducing that. Now, if you're a masochist and you enjoy pain and you really want to question things in life, then by all means, hit that subscribe button.
I'm drawn to it already. All right. Well, Kyle, Steve, thanks again for coming on. It's been a ton of fun. And thanks for everyone for watching and also contributing in the live chat. So until next time.